Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everyone to the March work session of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. We have a very long and important work session agenda, but before we do that, I would like to make two introductions and acknowledgments. First, the no longer acting Director of Rail and Public Transportation, Chip Badger, was appointed today by the Governor. And Chip, whom I've known for almost 20 years, and you were an old-timer by the time I met you. No one knows more about transit, and particularly the properties in Virginia, than Chip. Whether it's a small rural system or the metro system, we are so blessed to have Chip with us to provide the leadership in the one area that where we're at least stable and in some aspects actually growing. And so congratulations,
Thank
Chip.
You very
it's,
much.
It's really a testament to you are a consensus figure in a very tough industry, and I appreciate your great work and leadership and look forward to more. Secondly, I would like to acknowledge the presence of Mr. Quentin Kendall. Mr. Kendall is trying to hide here on the front row, but Quentin is a former employee of the Commonwealth and most recently the Chief of Staff to Secretary Mary Peters from the United States Department of Transportation. And Mr. Kendall had oversight for ports, for aviation, for highways, for transit, the whole gamut of things that we deal with here. And he's come back to the Commonwealth, and we just want to welcome you back to the safe ground of the Commonwealth, Quentin. And we hope to see you at many future Commonwealth Transportation Board meetings as well. Thank you. With that, I'd like to call up the first item on the agenda, which is Commissioner Eckern, to give us a recap of the 2008 Awards of Excellence. And I think it is important for all of us to stop and think, remember, and appreciate the excellent work that goes on day to day within our agencies of government. And Commissioner Eckern is going to talk to us a little bit about some of the VDOT awards, but please be mindful there are others. We're in a difficult period in government, but it is important to recognize and to reward excellence. Mm-hmm. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. Good afternoon, everybody. I wanted to spend a few minutes with you this afternoon telling you a couple of little stories that I've experienced over the last 2 weeks as I've been traveling around the Commonwealth. Last week, I had the opportunity, and the purpose of these stories is to talk to you a little bit about how we touch every Commonwealth citizen every day with the business that we do. And as I was traveling last week, we were holding some meetings in Salem and meeting with employees. I got to meet three of our employees that work in one of our area headquarters. And during the last snowstorm, on their own initiative, as a result of a call from family members, they went out and rescued some folks that were trapped in a car. Used a motor grader, went out, got them, and retrieved them. I had the opportunity to have dinner with that superintendent and the two equipment operators last Monday night. Humble, very self-effacing, and very respectful of the job they have to do. But they were saying, this is just the normal course of us doing our jobs. There's nothing special. And I had to remind them that it is very special. And that happens every day across the Commonwealth as we focus our organization. It's something I'm really proud of. And while I'm going to highlight some folks here this afternoon that are really doing good things and have been recognized nationally, I wanted to start with that little story because it highlights just exactly what happens every day around the Commonwealth where our staff are recognized. for that excellence of service. And at your places, I think Carol has handed out, or is handing out, a little document similar to the one we prepared last year about this time for you, which was our first review of national and regional recognitions that our staff has achieved. This year, it takes on, for me, even more significance. Because as you review the 44 awards that are highlighted from this last year, it is not about the things. It is about the professionals and the staff who did it. And I've asked 10 of those recipients to be with us this afternoon. Now, last year I had this great PowerPoint, and I forgot to push the button because we had great pictures and all that kind of stuff. So they won't let me do that anymore. So this year, I'm just going to ask them to stand up as I kind of highlight those 10 recognitions that we've received. We also have a press release that we shared with you as a part of this. There's some irony in a couple of these recognitions as you think about the conversations that we're having with the citizens around the Commonwealth. And so it's really kind of pleasurable to be able to talk about this. The first individual I want to stand up is Rob Hoffericker.
I'm not in bad role. No, I already talked to the folks, but you know, they all go to the bad role. You can't do it. You've got to call us folks. Well, now we're going to go to the bad role.
Rob's been recognized as our recipient from Scenic Virginia for their anti-litter award for our Adopt a Highway program. The award honors anti-litter cleanup programs throughout the Commonwealth. Our VDOT Adopt a Highway program was recognized to commemorate the program's 20th anniversary as a program within VDOT. Rob is the central office leader of that program. And I, very frankly, am really proud. That's a national program, and when we get that kind of recognition among all the other states, I'm pretty impressed with that, and I really appreciate it. Thank you, Rob. The second program I want to highlight, or the second award I want to highlight, is the 2008 SWAM Innovator Award for a large agency. I've got Linda Cheatham and her staff and some representatives from Grindley Johnson's staff here. So they got it. And what we're recognizing with this program is the Business Opportunity and Workforce Development Center. That's the new center that has been developed to help businesses get into our business. And this board been extremely supportive in authorizing that program. This award recognizes state entities that have developed and implemented a non-traditional approach to increasing their SWAM expenditures through the use of creative, strategic, and effective means that can be used as a model of best practice, benchmarked by another state agency. The BOUT Center was established to provide those support services and training for a select group of SWAM vendors and disadvantaged business enterprises. One-on-one assistance is the key to success. And that's really what that center is accomplishing for us. And it's these individuals that have project. How we bring people together. You've seen a piece of how we help business. And I want to highlight a piece, an award around innovation. The first place 2008 Best of Web and Digital Government Award that we received from the Center for Digital Government The award was for the dashboard that was featured in the 2008 Digital States. That's dashboard 3.0. That's the comprehensive measurement tool, obviously, that you and the department uses to go beyond on time and on budget. Dr. Gary Allen and John Tom received those awards. Here is an award. The next one I want to highlight is also in the technology arena, dealing with a website that was developed without consultant support. Presented by the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials, and it's for our Highway Safety Challenge website. That's the cooperative effort between DMV, Virginia State Police, and VDOT. And you've seen the campaign posters, the Highway Safety Challenge, that are all over the city. Last year, the three agency heads did over a half a dozen joint events together to highlight the campaign that is important, and it was a piece, I believe, helping the state achieve the lowest ever fatality in the last, I believe, the last 15 years. That campaign and that website were developed through our central office public affairs group, and Shannon Marshall is the spark plug that made that happen. That is, she is just a dynamo. You gotta really appreciate what she does. The next award we got was from the Southeastern Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials this year. It was for innovative, it's their Innovative Management Award for the I-64 New Kent Rest Area. LEED certified, it is recognized nationally as one of the best reconstruction projects for facilities. That has been done in this kind of a program. The key people that make that come together to create that environmentally friendly state-owned building and was honored as a sustainable energy and its design features, recycling is the key to that program. But Robbie Prozioso and Jake Porter are the people that make that kind of program come together. Extremely gratified about, and it was just a labor of love for the staff of the department to undertake. We got the Champions of Employment Award from the Virginia Department of Rehabilitative Services for our Wounded Veterans Internship Program. That award honors individuals and organizations from public, private, and non-profit sectors that champion the employment of people with disabilities by promoting disability-friendly practices in the workplace. The award, this particular award, recognizes VDOT's program designed for veterans who find that they, as they re-enter our job market, need a different environment. VDOT's program is the only one of its kind among departments of transportation across the country. That program was very lovingly designed by the Civil Rights Division and Levi Carey. I am really proud of what those people have done to bring that program to life. Couple of awards I want to highlight are highlighted even in the course of all the hard work that we're doing in the department now as we address that organization of the future that we're having to put together in the next 12 months. there are two awards that were presented by the Association of Equipment Management Professionals to the staff of our department. The first is the Fleet Masters Award, which recognizes equipment professionals who excel in meeting unique challenges inherent to delivering cost-effective management of mixed fleets on-road and off-road equipment. VDOT was cited for the Equipment Program Business Process Improvement Plan, which has been enhanced with industry-related performance measures that have been a tool for improving key areas of the program. I actually participated last fall in that award activity that went on. It is extremely impressive when you look at our staff and the qualifications that they have earned. That program is driven by an individual I have really come to like. He struggles with me every now and then because we have a joke that I won't use in public that we share between us. But Earl Potter, our state equipment manager, is really the guy behind that process. He's also here to recognize and represent one of the individuals who was recognized as the Public Fleet Technician of the Year. Craig Doner works in our Fredericksburg district. He can't be here. But that top award, awarded to Craig last fall by the same Association of Equipment Management Professionals. You know the nice thing about that award? They don't give you a trophy. They give them a neat toolbox. It's a meaningful award. It is really neat. It recognizes equipment. That award recognizes equipment technicians who exemplify the prototypical professional technician based on their performance in each of the following skill sets: occupational and environmental safety, community service, use of technology, the ethics they bring to the job, innovation and initiative, technical proficiency, continuing education and experience, and showing a customer-centric attitude. And Craig really showed that at these awards. I got a chance to talk to him just a little bit. Here representing him is, again, Earl Potter. So, Earl, when you stand up, you really look like Craig. The last award I want to highlight this afternoon is again an actual award for a publication geared to work with our employees. And last year we received the employee newsletter publication was recognized for its writing, graphics, photography, and focus approach to internal communications. That publication, which is also web-based, was designed based on what our employees were asking for in terms of information flow. Jeff Caldwell and his staff did just an absolutely great job of taking all our old newsletters, listening to our employees, and redesigning this publication. One of the driving forces behind that redesign is with us this afternoon, and that's Britt Bruce. Mr. Secretary, I really appreciate you providing me the opportunity to do this on an annual basis. I can't do everybody, and there's always a fear of leaving somebody out, but I can't pass up these kinds of opportunities to highlight these stressful times, economic change, all the things that the staff of this department is working on simultaneously, and they still achieve this level of excellence and are recognized nationally. I'm really proud to be a part of that group. Thank you very much for giving me these few minutes.
Thank you, Commissioner, and I want to express my appreciation and the governor's for you to aggregate these awards. Sometimes when they happen a little bit over time, we don't realize, and we've only heard four or five here this afternoon. The handout for those in the audience, there's about 15 or 20 incredible national and statewide awards for this organization. And I think it's just a tribute to the pluck, the hard work, and the commitment of the employees of the department. I'd welcome any comments from other members of the board. Mr. McCarthy.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What a wonderful opportunity in these difficult financial times to be able to recognize VDOT and its thousands of employees, of whom these couple of dozen represent the tip of a wonderfully effective iceberg, as it were. In the face of the sometimes just uninformed, to find a polite word, criticism of VDOT being a haven of waste and fraud, that's just wasting taxpayer money, I think these type of national recognition for the hard work done by the VDOT employees is the best answer to that kind of nonsense. And I, for one, am really getting sick about hearing it at public hearings and reading about it in the newspapers. People who say that clearly have no idea what they're talking about, and I would invite them to come sit down and chat with us and learn what's really going on before they keep popping off with ill-informed opinions about what and how VDOT actually works. We're doing the very best we can here at VDOT and at DRPT too, I'm sure, and to listen to that kind of nonsense is really offensive, and I just think we ought to tackle it head on and call the bullies out and not let them get away with that kind of nonsense.
Thank you, Mr. McCarthy, and I think you, there's a motion on the floor.
Second.
You know, all of us have felt that, and I think all of us are judicious, but I do think particularly in the last couple of weeks there have been some examples of excess that are not in the Virginia tradition, and particularly in light of the good work that's underway there. So we hear your passion, and we hear your truth. Thank you very much. Any other comments among board members? Commissioner, thank you once again for bringing these together. I think it's so helpful for us to see this all in one place, and it sure makes an impression on the governor as well. if we might turn to item two on the agenda, which is an update on the stimulus program. The first presentation will be a joint presentation of Rita Buescher and Mal Curley on the stimulus package. I do want to share with folks that this is an update, as this is a process and a one-time program which is still under development. I suspect at the end of the presentation there will be a number of questions. We'll attempt to answer them. In terms of process, we can talk about those in more detail at the end. But we have made a commitment to work collaboratively with the congressional delegation, with the General Assembly leadership, with the Commonwealth Transportation Board, obviously, with the Metropolitan Planning Organizations and affected local governments. And very, very importantly, something that gets lost sometimes in our focus is on an industry that is struggling. And the transportation construction industry, whether it's highways, whether it's bridge, or whether it's rail, is as economically fragile as any other industry in the U.S. And they're not asking for a bailout. They're simply asking for work. And so that's part of what this Recovery Act is about. And I think you'll see we have made some substantial progress in defining broad categories of use and a way forward. So thank you, Ms. Buescher, and you'll be followed up by the Chief Engineer, Mr. Curley, when your part of the presentation is done.
Good afternoon. As you recall, recently you reduced and amended the fiscal year 2009. Is it not on?
No, you have to learn. You got to be like me, talk loud and boring.
As you all will remember, you reduced and amended the fiscal year 2009 through 14 6-year improvement program on February 13th. 2009. The President signed the Recovery Act on February 17, 2009, and FHWA provided apportionment numbers to VDOT on March 3, 2009, which started the 120-day clock for obligating the first 50% of those stimulus dollars by June 30, 2009. Now, the governor will certify the state's maintenance of effort by March 19, 2009. Actually, that's tomorrow. What that means is that we will certify that the amount of state resources on federally qualifying projects or activities is at a certain level, and we will maintain that between February 17th through September 30th of 2010. The governor will also have to certify that individual infrastructure investments have received the full review and vetting required by the Act and accept responsibility that the infrastructure investment is an appropriate use of taxpayers' dollars. The governor has already certified on March 3rd that Virginia will request and use the ARRA funds, and that the ARRA funds will be used to create jobs and promote economic growth. This page summarizes the distribution of the Virginia Highway funding from the Recovery Act. Virginia will receive $694 million, of which 3% for enhancement comes off the top, and that equates to approximately $20.8 million, for a net figure of $673.6 million. From there, we apply the STP population formula, statewide transportation program population formula, and that equates to about 30% of our statewide allocation. Now, the three urbanized metropolitan planning organizations will receive, with populations greater than the 200,000, will receive $117 million from this sub-allocation. In localities with, or areas with population less than 200,000, their population distribution of the Recovery Act funding is $90.5 million for a total sub-allocation of $208.3 million. That leaves the remaining 67% net discretionary funding of $465.3 million approximately. Now, as I mentioned a moment ago, of the $208.3 million that is divided up based on the STP population formula, the Richmond MPO will receive $24.1 million, the Hampton Roads area will receive $41 million, and Northern Virginia will receive $52.7 million. And that is the total of the 117.8. And those three MPO areas and the urban areas will be selecting their projects using that $117 million. The $90.5 million is part of the VDOT discretionary money, but must be approved and included in the MPOs throughout the state in their STIP. The federal priorities for the Recovery Act funding and use of that funding is that we must meet all normal federal project requirements. They also prefer that the money be spent on projects that will be complete within 3 years, and that time frame is February 2012. That's based on the date that the Act was signed by the President. And that we give some priority to economically distressed areas, and we've shown you that graphically in previous presentations, but the two requirements would be per capita income is 80% of the national average, or unemployment rate is at least 1% higher than the statewide formula, or population rate, unemployment rate. excuse me. Now, the Commonwealth priorities, which we have also discussed previously, but we'll talk in more detail today, are our structurally deficient bridges, and I'll leave that for the chief engineer to discuss further. Also, the deficient pavements. Another priority is BRAC-related projects that are in areas where a tremendous number of new jobs will be created or moved to areas in Virginia. And then we also will be looking at the canceled or delayed construction projects that we took out of our revised 9 through 14 program and the citizen suggestions that have been posted to the governor's website, and that is now, those projects are being reviewed. To give you an idea of the type of, or the quantity of dollars and projects that have been submitted to the governor's website, the projects total $466 billion in Virginia. That's for all types of projects submitted on the website. Of that, $194 billion is related to transportation projects, or about 42% of the total of the 9,160 projects submitted. Of the 9,000 projects, 1,800 were transportation, and that's about 20% of the 9,100 projects. So you can see transportation was obviously an important component of the citizens' input to the government. I'll turn it over now to the chief engineer.
Welcome, Mr. Curley.
Thank you, Rita. It's not often recently I get to come up after Rita and ask you to try to spend some money that we're going to get. First thing I want to talk a little bit about is the state of the industry. I see Jeff Southern of VTCA is in the audience, probably knows this much better than I do. Economically fragile, as the Secretary mentioned a few minutes ago. Industry's reporting loss of hundreds of jobs. These job losses across the industry are with contractors, consultants, suppliers, and all those other businesses that work with them. Seasonal layoffs may equate to permanent layoffs because of lack of work. A concern to VDOT is the impact on the future. The permanent business losses of people going out of business for good. We have contractors, consultants relocating resources outside the state, going to other states to try to find work. And then some of them changing the work mix that they actually have. Instead of doing 70% of VDOT work, they're going to do 20% and change their workforce. So that equates to them bidding on less VDOT work in the future, which impacts competition, et cetera, impacts our costs. So a little bit of background there on talking with the industry, some of the concerns they have. Now, as far as projects, and we have been working on this for some time, and I think some of the board members have been talking with their district administrators and their staffs in the districts, and I appreciate the efforts that they have of looking at things that we could do. We've got about 110 to 120 small bridges and culvert candidates for design-build contracts. These are going to be throughout the state. These are structurally deficient bridges, or if I'm saying obsolete bridges, basically structurally deficient bridges, general condition rating of 4 or less. These are projects that can move very quickly, no right-of-way, we've cleared the environmental concerns on them, and we estimate that the value of what we'd like to move forward is in the neighborhood of $60 to $70 million. This could go fairly rapidly. We have been coordinating with the FHWA and other people. The next slide talks about... Yes.
Quick question. You talk about a score of 4 or less. What's that on a scale of 1 to 10? Is that 1 to 50?
It's 1 to 10. Yes, sir. That's the federal definition of what becomes structurally deficient. If you have a general condition rating on any of one of your elements less than 4 or less, that particular structure is listed as structurally deficient. Looking at deficient pavements, another priority. We hope to address between 400 and 500 lane miles of interstate and primary highway candidate projects for major paving and overlay. These would have pavement indexes of 53, which is listed poor or less for most of the segment, and our recommendations from the districts. We do have a couple projects we're looking at where the index is a little bit higher than 53, but I personally talked to district administrators in those areas. We have some outdated indexes we're looking at and some reconstruction as opposed to trying to put an overlay on a project. These also will require no right-of-way or environmental documentation, and we're looking to advertise maybe $100 to $150 million of deficient paving projects around the state.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Now, what about the supplier side on asphalting? Is that going to put a crunch on them? Are we going to be able to get the adequate supply of asphalting?
Yeah, I believe we're going to be able to do the asphalt industry the last few years. The numbers of tonnage is going down. Commissioner met with the industry last year. We talk in terms of budget and dollars. They talk in terms of tonnage. And if you look at the amount of tonnage of asphalt we've done the last few years, it's been tailing down. Obviously, it's going to be dependent on when the projects are advertised, time of the year, and when they can get their stone ready, and how quickly they can get to it would be a concern. But I'm not concerned with the capacity of the industry to deliver.
Ms. Curley, the index of 53, that's on a scale of
1 to 100.
Okay. So again, a failing grade.
Yes, sir. The next category has to do with the BRAC projects. There are several BRAC projects we're looking at. Fort Lee and Richmond, about 7,800 BRAC projects, Route 36, Prince George County, City of Hopewell, Fort Eustis and Hampton Roads, about 1,700 BRAC projects, BRAC jobs coming there, Fort Eustis Boulevard, New York County, and City of Newport News. In Fort Belvoir, Fairfax County Parkway in Fairfax County, 11,900 BRAC jobs coming in that area. Quantico, the Fuller Road entrance, another 2,500 BRAC jobs coming in that area. The Defense Intelligence Agency in the Culpeper area off of Route 29, an entrance improvement off of 29, 1,000 BRAC jobs in there. We estimate moving some of these projects forward would be in the $80 to $100 million range. Projects would move forward to support BRAC.
Ms. Kerr, I might just add there, the commissioner about a year and a half ago appointed a statewide BRAC coordinator who has, we simply have not had the resources, but in the current economic climate, these are pretty staggering job numbers. And one of the intents here is to recognize and maintain the growth of our military installations. The Department of Defense is the single largest employer in the Commonwealth, so this is important. Some of these projects, there may be local dollars, there may be proper funds or other sources for them, so these likely would not be 100% stimulus funded, but they're important local and private partnerships.
The next area has to do with enhancements. As Rita said, that's about $20.8 million. The timeline requires a small number of projects, looking at maybe some ongoing construction projects or program, looking at major trail projects, especially those that deal with tourism and economic development potential. As I indicated, it'd be between $20 and $21 million of enhancement-type projects.
Mr. Chairman, could I just say, will we go through the similar established process for that, or is that going to be done on an expedited?
It's going to be on an expedited, but I assume the Secretary and the Commissioner want to go through a similar type process or make a proposal. That's still being discussed right now, and we'll wait to see with that. Which leads us to the money we would have left after addressing those particular priorities. We've canceled about $3 billion of our delayed construction projects recently. We have a $194 billion in citizen suggestions. It's a 158-page document. I have it in that notebook if you'd like to look at it. We have between $250 to $350 million left in stimulus funding after we address what I indicated before, the deficient bridges, deficient pavements, BRAC, and required set-asides. And when I say we're going to address those, we are not going to resolve the problems of deficient bridges or deficient pavements. We're trying to address them. And, for instance, in the bridge area, we will eliminate at one time about 111 structurally deficient bridges or culverts from our inventory and two functionally obsolete bridges or culverts from our inventory. We have ongoing coordination with the governor's office, congressional delegation, General Assembly, the CTB here, MPOs, the FHWAs, localities, and we try to meet and keep the industry informed of what's going on. The next steps that we have, as Rita was indicating, the certifications the governor needs to give, so we have the governor's certifications and decisions. VDOT and DRP budget amendments for FY09, 6-year improvement amendments for 2009-2014, STIP and TIP amendments, obligating the funds to project, and advertising projects. VDOT, there is a reporting requirement to the feds, and we have been working very closely with the Federal Highway Administration. We will need to report monthly on the number of newly hired employees and the number of existing employees. This information will be include the number of employees, total hours for employees, total wages for employees, subtotal of new hires and existing. This is something, as we advertise contracts, Byron staff has been working with the FHWA of what type of information we're going to need. We will require the contractor to provide that information to us so as we can review this data, certify it, provide it to the Federal Highway Administration. We also, no later than 10 business days after each letting, we are going to have to report the FHWA with summary bid information and specific information on projects that are to be awarded. The Secretary mentioned a minute ago on that we may have some other funding on those BRAC-type things. What we would like to do is minimizing as much as possible mixing funds because of the reporting relationships and the requirements that we would have on contractors. So that's why we're trying to work. Rita staff is doing a great job looking at what we have of where funding is and what we could fund from stimulus money and other monies available to the department. Now, Rita will be more than happy to answer any questions you have.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, I have a broad question. Does the governor's certification of maintenance of level of effort impose any new legal obligations on the Commonwealth? For example, to provide adequate revenues to support that plan?
The certification indicates we'll maintain our dollar the state dollar or resources on planned projects and maintenance projects. What that does, if we don't aren't diverted from that amount, then we can continue to be available to receive redistributions of federal funding in federal fiscal 2011. In terms of legal requirements, I can't speak to that. I'd say no. It's just we are certifying that maintenance of effort, the state support to our program, will be maintained.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I had jumped ahead a little bit and looked at your next presentation about the difficulties or the possibilities that state revenues would continue to decline and possibly federal revenues as well. So, are we certifying something that we actually don't know that we can do? And if so, that's the reason I was asking about the legal obligation, because, quite frankly, I think it's a good way to trap us into providing more revenue.
finding more revenue.
How cool is that?
We're actually certifying our plans, maintenance of effort as of the enactment, or as of the signing of the Recovery Act, February 17th.
Okay. Second question, Mr. Chairman.
If I might provide just a little bit of clarification on that, it's for a 14-month period?
February 17th through September 30th of 2010.
So a little bit, about 18-month period. And that was one of the reasons we did have a special meeting in the Commonwealth Transportation Board. If the governor were to have certified the prior six-year program, there is no way we would have been able to meet that maintenance of effort clause. That's the best available information in that 18 to 20-month period. We think we have a reasonable shot at that. I would say if we further reduce state revenues, and again, jumping ahead, we may be in a position of leaving federal dollars on the table. That's where our program has gotten to.
The second question more specifically refers to later in the presentation, which is we didn't fully allocate some of our own funds in anticipation of there being some stimulus requirements that might require us to use those funds. Does this clear the way for us to now allocate those funds in the six-year improvement plan, our own funds?
The Federal Reserve that we set aside or did not obligate for 10 through 14 when we revised the program was set aside because we weren't sure of the normal federal funding levels for 10 forward. It didn't have to do with using that money for stimulus.
Okay, so it was a longer term reserve.
Any other questions or comments?
Yes, sir. There's been some question about whether projects have to be in the six-year package or not. We've said we're going to try to look at those that were cut off of the six-year plan. What is the requirement?
The projects that are certified for stimulus funding by the governor must be in the SIP at the MPO level, and that should match the six-year improvement program. So we would amend the six-year improvement program and the SIP for anything that we're proposing to use stimulus dollars for.
This is a mechanical question, I think. On MPOs of less than 200,000, I think I understood you to say that that those funds, the $90 million, are part of the discretionary funding, but they still must go through the MPO. And I guess my question is how, in districts where you have that smaller MPO, how the decision-making process comes together with VDOT decisions and CTB decisions and the MPO decisions.
We'll be looking at the projects that fall in those areas, those population areas, and we will actually know which ones they are when we meet with the MPOs to amend the STIP. They will at that time provide us feedback on those projects. We'll be recommending a list of projects. We already know, for example, the pavement and the bridges, where they would fall, whether they're in an MPO, whether they're in an economically disadvantaged region of the state based on the information that we have. So we'll be able to look at our projects and make sure that we're obligating that $90 million in population areas less than 200, and we'll present that to the MPOs for their review and approval through the STIP update.
To follow up with Dwight's question, can you guide us through the process? You say you're going to be meeting with the MPOs. How will that actually work?
I would say that we're going to be asking them to be calling special meetings to meet our time commitments on obligating the funds. Once we nail down the full scope of the projects that we're recommending and go through the vetting process in terms of the governor's office and you all in the General Assembly and the whole list of folks that we are working with, then we would ask them to meet with us. We would make a presentation. There would be give and take and feedback.
They used to do it that way.
And hopefully they would approve the inclusion in their STIP.
You hope there will be agreement.
Yes, sir.
I think it's safe to say that this is a convoluted and circular process that most of us are blissfully spared from. But in a very short period of time, we have to obtain the concurrence of the governor, the congressional delegation, the General Assembly leadership, Commonwealth Transportation Board, the Metropolitan Planning Organizations, the affected localities, and the industries that will actually be doing the hard work. And so this is not a linear process. And it does not fit on any flow chart known to mankind. And it's very difficult to try and compress this in a short period of time. That's one of the reasons that the staff presentation is trying to focus on known categories of need. We've all talked about bad bridges, bad pavements. There are certain things we have to do in set-asides. BRAC is an obvious category with the job growth as something to promote. After that, it's going to be very challenging and very difficult when we have, as I recall, about $195 billion worth of project requests and $250 to $350 million of actual funding to satisfy those needs.
Mr. Chairman, I would imagine that Virginia is not unlike other states in terms of trying to qualify for, identify projects, and get the stimulus money into the economy. And each state would have some format similar to what we're going through here, some approval process or selection process. And then I must assume that these announcements that we hear, like Maryland is letting projects using stimulus money, that's not accurate, because I think it would be suspect at this point that they could do that quick. Would you think that would be?
Well, no, they have the state of Maryland has let stimulus projects. My understanding, and there are two reasons for that. One is they had a list of essentially maintenance projects that were ready to go and would have been bid with traditional funding sources. They were able to use stimulus funding on that, you know, to do it quickly. They also had concurrence that there would not be any additional rules implemented by their General Assembly. And so one of the issues here in Virginia has been working through a process, and we are continuing on a daily basis to work through that process of consultation as opposed to legislative approval. There are a number of states where the executive branch has been required to come back with very specific project lists for approval by their legislative bodies. And that is we're fortunate. We're sort of in middle ground. There's a small number of states that have been given, broad latitude, executive latitude. There's a large number of states that have to go back for General Assembly, very specific project level approval. We've arrived at a process of informal consultation with the General Assembly leadership.
Mr. Bowie.
Mr. Chairman, the $20 million enhancement funds, is that in addition to the enhancement projects we've just approved or have just recommended?
Yes.
Will this be going back out to the board members as the original enhancement funds did?
If I might, Mr. Bowie, there's not enough time to go through that process, but I would say every project in this package requires the final approval of this body. So pavement, it requires an allocation and a project designation, and so the enhancement projects will be treated in a similar fashion. The suggestion in the presentation was because of the timelines, we don't have the luxury of sending out applications, getting them back on a district basis, and looking at a couple of hundred project submissions. We're going to have to make, staff is going to make some recommendations on a smaller number of projects, again, for consideration by the board. Okay. Any other questions or comments?
Well, only to the extent that Mr. Boyd's question makes me ask, will there be any, or can we arrange some opportunity for this body to have some input on the selection of those enhancement projects that the staff's been recommended?
Yes, sir. And what we may want to do is have the enhancement staff on that issue talk about it as we get in these broad categories. When we get to a level of comfort that the numbers are right, that the federal highways can meet those, there will be the district level consultation on bridges, pavements, enhancements, BRAC, and then the other projects. And it's the other projects that are going to be the difficult ones.
Thank you.
I guess I was wondering what the cutoff, say, with deficient pavements. I'm sure we could spend more than $150 million. How did that decision, in the same way with the bridges, could we not just really eliminate more of our bridge problems?
Yeah, I've been working with the district since about November, December last year, and they have submitted their recommendations, and I've cut those down, and then I asked them for things that could be ready to go by 1st of April. First of February, and they came in, and I cut those down to get to the number that you're at right now. I had after my first cut, I had over $350 million worth of paving things we were looking at. Likewise, Ken Wallace and his staff has worked very closely with the Federal Highway Administration, each of the district bridge offices, to look at projects similar to what we did when we got redistribution funding, to move things very quickly, and they set a criteria of what we were looking for, types of projects looking for. At one time we were at 76, and then we were up at 90, and we ended up at 111. Trying to look across the state. We would probably, in that instance, look about seven design-build contracts. So there's seven opportunities for people to get work, and these would be bridges almost in every district but one that this thing would touch. And then there are some other regular projects that have a possibility of replacement bridges in those too. But it was basically by time criteria. Back in November, December, we didn't know what the rules were going to be of how to do it, so we set some things down and looking to just reduce the number of structurally deficient bridges that we have.
And so what I'm hearing is it's the time of getting the project started that was one of the major criteria for separating the projects that are desirable from the ones that you knew you could get going.
And I would add on that, and several to the point, the process of informal consultation has made it clear at several layers of governance that all bridges and all pavement is not acceptable. And different parts of the state have different needs. So like everything we do, we've got to strike a balance here. I think all of us recognize our unmet needs and pavements and bridges vastly exceed the amount shown here, but we do have to listen to the congressional delegation who ultimately are responsible for this money, the General Assembly. Obviously the governor's going to have a final say in all of this, but that's a you point to a very important tension here. We really have focused on just fixing bad bridges and bad highways. We will not be able to devote as many resources as we need to in this area. We're going to have to strike a balance among economic development, mobility, as well as the safe maintenance of the bridges and highway. Ms. Carter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll go back to Mr. Bowie's statement. I represent a few small cities and towns, and their economic, they depend on tourists. And of course, there are many that I did recommend enhancement funds for, but I did have to cut quite a bit that I would like to have extended the funding for them. May we submit to staff funding requests for those, for the projects that have been submitted to us and have a percentage that is high on the priority list, that we could increase some of our funding to these smaller cities and towns who want to revitalize, who depend on the economy crisis to build up from tourists, that we can suggest to staff the suggestion that where we would like to increase funding.
Everyone's open to suggestions. We've got $192 billion of them. It won't hurt to get a few more in the mix. And, you know, the board is going to has the, you know, the final action and say over projects. But I do have to emphasize what you will be involved at the district level, but we have this a process of talking, again, to all those other actors and entities out there who also have strong interests as well.
And I'm sure they do, and I appreciate their interest also. And but I'll be spending a couple of days in those areas. And if I see something that is catching my eye that I feel that would be an enhancement to what they want, you know, what they need, not what they want, but what they need because of the economic crisis and the tourists in that area, I would like to feel, as a CDB member, that I could request more funding on a project that has already been in the has been presented to me.
Okay. I would suggest any board members, if you want to mail those project requests to either Ms. Busher or Mr. Curley, that would be very welcome. My guess is it's probably out on the governor's website already, but never hurts to ask a couple of times. Any other questions or comments? If not, we're going to turn to the second half of the Recovery Act presentation, which is rail and public transportation. Welcome, Director Badger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last month, we gave you a presentation on the rail and public transportation components of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009. We know a little bit more information than we did a month ago, but as you'll see, there's still a lot of information to be provided yet. This provides a quick overview of the funding for rail and public transportation. We do have $8.4 billion that's been allocated for transit in essentially three categories. Some of the money is allocated by formula, and the Federal Register has come out with the appropriations for the urbanized areas and states. And you'll see a number for Virginia that has been published in some press releases of $116 million. The only thing I'd point out to you is that $116 million does include a portion of the Washington, D.C. metropolitan urbanized area allocation. So if you tried to go in and add the numbers up, it would be next to impossible to do. The federal rail program is at $9.3 billion with money for high-speed and intercity rail and Amtrak services. These will be the Amtrak money we'll talk about in a little bit. The high-speed rail money and intercity rail money will be on a competitive basis, so we won't know what we're going to get there until we actually apply. And then, of course, there's the Secretary of Transportation's discretionary program of $1.5 billion. This is for projects of regional or national significance. They can be used for any highway or transit program, but they can also be used for passenger rail and freight rail and for ports. And that makes this program a little bit unique. And again, that will be a competitive grant on a nationwide basis. Turning to the transit capital program, all but $100 million of this number here, the $6.9 billion nationwide, is distributed by formula. The funds have already been apportioned, and the deadline for obligating these funds is within 180 days of enactment of the bill. And the funding will be available through 2010. They do have another program. It's called Energy-Related Investments. $100 million in discretionary funds. It's It's going to be for capital only that is designed to reduce the energy consumption of the transit system itself. They have not issued the guidelines on that yet, so we are waiting to learn more about that. I'm not sure if the state would be eligible to apply for that or not. We certainly will if we can. And for these programs, all of these programs, the federal share is at 100%. With the formula, the federal, as I mentioned, the Federal Register is out. These are the actual allocations of stimulus money to Virginia. The number you see there for Washington, D.C. is the entire urbanized area allocation. They've got about $215 million. They have a sub-agreement with Potomac and Rappahannock Transportation Commission and Virginia Railway Express. They receive a portion of their annual allocations under these two federal programs. So we know the numbers for those two systems. PRTC is getting about $4 million and VRE is getting just under $10 million. And by the way, we estimate that the Virginia portion of the WMATA allocation is about $50 million. Hampton Roads will get $25 million, and most of that goes to the Hampton Roads Transit, or HRT, and then the Williamsburg Area Transport will get a little over $1 million as well. GRTC here in Richmond gets just under $14 million. Now, the large systems have pretty much already identified the projects that they intend to pursue with that. PRTC is going to be doing some capital cost of contracting and buying some buses. VRE intends to use their money for purchase of locomotives. WMATA has a whole list of improvements that they're going to be using their money for. Hampton Roads Transit is going to be using their money for the Southside bus maintenance facility that they have underway. Greater Richmond Transit Company plans to use the money for downtown transfer center and or bus purchases. So they're ready to go, and I would guess that they will use all of their money or obligate all of their money very early in the process, certainly in the first year. Now, we also receive, as a state, an allocation of money for our rural areas and for our small urban areas. As you can see from the slide, we have about $30.5 million for transit capital projects. These money come to the state, and they're divided up among the transit system by the CTB. And so we will be making a recommendation to you, actually next month, on allocations of some of these funds. Now, all of these funds are available for 2 years. You have to spend at least half of it in the first year. We will certainly come to you with a program that spends at least half of our urban and small urban and rural money in the first year. Then we'll probably have to go out with another solicitation later in the year to get the rest of the money obligated. It's thrown our timeline off a little bit, but we're going to make sure we don't lose any of this transit money. Another category called fixed guideway transit. This is actually distributed, again, by formula, generated by the number of fixed guideway miles that a transit system operates. Of course, Metro Rail and VRE generate those funds. You see a number in there for Hampton Roads. It shows up as light rail, but Hampton Roads actually gets fixed guideway mileage for their ferry system. They will certainly get a lot more fixed guideway transit when they start their light rail system. But these are the allocations, and again, these will be used for transit capital projects, and I'm sure they will both be obligated very quickly. There's also $750 million available nationwide for what we call New Starts projects. These funds will go to projects that are already have a full funding grant agreement or can be obligated within 150 days of enactment. We hope to get some money for Dulles and Norfolk Light Rail under this. This $750 million is about half of the annual allocation under the New Starts program, so it's not a great deal of money. We do hope to get some advanced funding for both Dulles and Norfolk Light Rail. Any money that we get would be within the full funding grant agreement, so it's not like you can get more than what the federal government has promised you on this. It's just a matter of getting the money early. So we're hopeful to see some advanced payments there. Moving on to the rail program. Again, there's an $8 billion program. It's often referred to as just the high-speed rail program. But we want to point out it's also available for inter-city rail. One of the first things that Federal Railroad Administration has been confronted with is what's the definition of high-speed rail. And they've come out with some guidance on this already. The act that was passed last fall had a definition that you see down there at the bottom that talks about the rail service that can be operated at speeds at least 110 miles per hour. They've kind of backed off of that a little bit in their recent guidance. Now, I'm not going to read it to you, but you can see above what the most recent definition of high-speed rail is. I think they're going to be a little bit more inclusive. They also have indicated that they will be providing some additional guidance on this definition in the very near future. They have promised to come out with what they're calling their strategic plan, the 18th of April. It will be submitted to the House and the Senate. It's going to set out the procedures and the rules, and I hope a distribution of how the funds will be awarded among the three different programs that these funds are eligible for. Very clearly, the priority for all this funding will be for inner-city high-speed rail passenger service. Like I mentioned, there are three categories of funding that these funds can be assigned to. High-speed rail is one. This is a new program. Inner-city rail is a program that they first received funding for this past year. The program was funded in FY08 at $30 million. We received a $2 million grant on that, so we're very familiar with that. And then there is a third category called congestion-related projects. These are projects that have to be designated by either Amtrak, the Surface Transportation Board, or the Secretary of Transportation. Again, they're intended to support rail projects and congested corridors and projects that increase ridership on intercity rail. As I mentioned, the guidance on actually applying for the money will be coming out by the 19th of June. We have begun to identify projects already for our rail enhancement plan and our rail resource allocation plan and our statewide rail plan. We've been thinking about this for a long time, so we have a number of projects identified. We will be well positioned to move forward with on this. We work with the Federal Railroad Administration and Amtrak. We meet monthly with them on projects, so we have a lot of information. We're well positioned to submit our applications, and we're looking forward to that opportunity. And as soon as we get more information on what the rules are, the procedures are, we will certainly be sharing that with you. And again, the strategic plan is due by the middle of April, and the guidelines by June 19th. Amtrak also receiving $1.3 billion. They will make the decision on what projects they're going to pursue with that. They're actually due to make their announcement tomorrow. They're committed to make sure the projects are done within 2 years. The money's only available through 2010. They do have a set aside for security, and they have a limit on how much they can spend in the Northeast Corridor. They've already come out with a press release indicating some of the projects that they're going to be moving forward. I'm not sure if we'll see anything in Virginia or not, but I think we'll have opportunities for the other programs if we do not. There's no opportunity for the state to apply for these funds. It's simply a decision made by Amtrak. Finally, there's the supplemental discretionary funding that the Secretary of Transportation has available. It's $1.5 billion. It sounds like a lot of money until you divide it up by 50 states and works out to $30 million a state. They do have a commitment to come out with criteria within 90 days. That works out to May 18th. We're supposed to learn more about how to apply for that. And the applications will be due in August. Projects will be selected within a year. Again, the unique thing about this program is that not only can it be used for rail and transit and passenger rail, but it's also available for freight rail and port infrastructure projects. The guidelines indicate that grants probably will not be any smaller than $20 million and probably not more than $300 million, but it also gives the Secretary discretion to vary from that if the Secretary so choose. So coming up, these are the key dates. On the 19th of March, tomorrow, the Amtrak funds will be awarded. They'll decide what projects they're going forward with. At the next meeting of the Commonwealth Transportation Board, report. We're going to bring to you a list of rural and small urban projects. We actually have to ask you to approve those. Typically, we do that as part of the six-year update. But we have to get those into the federal process so they can be awarded on a much earlier date. They have to be put into transportation improvement programs and put into the review process by the U.S. Department of Labor and everything else. We're going to have to move early on that. Again, April 18th, FRA will release their strategic plan for high-speed rail and intercity rail. May 18th, we'll have the criteria for the discretionary grants that will be awarded by the Secretary of Transportation. June 19th, we'll have the guidance on how to apply for the rail grants. And then the rest of these dates are pretty self-explanatory, but we have a lot to do and not a whole lot of time. And with that, I will be happy to take any questions.
Questions for Mr. Bailey?
Is there any chance, Chip, that a new rail project, passenger rail project, could be looked at with the time frames that are here? For instance, something from northwestern into D.C.?
They are not even allowing us to use these funds for planning. So I wish I would say that in the timeline that we're talking about, there's really, if something isn't part of it.
How about acquisition of right-of-way?
Sorry?
How about acquisition of right-of-way?
We would have, before we could do anything like that, we would have to go through a planning process and an environmental process. So I don't think that it's reasonable to expect we'd be able to do anything totally.
So projects that do have a full funding grant agreement might be eligible for additional funds.
That's correct.
I think we have one of those now, Mr. Chairman. Bring to the attention of my colleagues. And those funds could, as you say, they wouldn't necessarily add to the funds, but they could shift funds forward and perhaps allow projects to proceed more quickly.
That's correct. And the full funding grant agreement will set out how much money that the state or the recipient can expect from the federal government towards that project. This will not increase that amount, but it may advance payment on some of those funds. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Badger. We look forward to seeing your first wave of grant recommendations next month.
Another thought, Mr. Chairman, and of course Chip referred to it in that he's going to do everything he can that we don't lose any money. Have we given thought or have a plan in place for VDOT or DRPT to look at the allocated funds on a national basis and how we're going to apply for those and be ready for those and be the first to be up front again?
Well, we're not sure how that will work for the various categories. I know the transit funds just revert back to the Treasury of the stimulus I assume you're talking about. It's unclear if highway funds will be available for a bonus redistribution. You know, we go through that every year, and we typically get $20 to $30 million in bonus redistribution. That's one of the reasons that maintenance of effort clause is so absolutely critical, because there's a chance that they may go back into a pot for redistribution in the states.
You ready?
Any other questions or comments? Thank you. Now, we're going to change emotional gears here a little bit. There are hopes and expectations around the stimulus program. I think folks can see that starting to take shape. We should not lose sight of the fact that normally at this time of the year we're talking about how to shape and fashion and designate priorities for the development of the six-year program. You're going to hear a presentation by Ms. Buescher and Mr. Pittard, which is not an encouraging note. And unfortunately, the work that we have done really over the last 18 months to significantly reduce the program will be forced to continue. And there are some very important and very sobering messages in here, both short-term and long-term, and so I urge you to pay careful attention to this because it's going to, again, mean some short-term and very difficult decisions. And also, I think, to some of the points Mr. McCarthy raised earlier, our long-term sustainability and viability of both highways and transit and rail are being called into question. And we're just now starting to get to the point where we can start to begin to digest the General Assembly budget actions, get through the stimulus package. The commissioner is going to be talking a little bit about update on the blueprint and some of the public hearings, the significant downsizing of the agencies. But if you stand up and even look out 10 years, and in many metropolitan areas, as you know, we have to do a very concerted, very detailed 20-year look, this is not a bright picture. So I would urge you to ask questions about specific terms and to give some hard thought and reflection to this presentation. And with that introduction, I'll turn it over to Ms. Buescher.
Thank you. As you're aware, since we revised the fiscal year 9 through 14 program just recently, that we are actually behind in starting this process. And at the end of the presentation, Mr. Pitter will provide you with a calendar of events, so to speak, our next steps. But it is, again, a short time frame for which to develop and approve the FY 10 through 15 six-year improvement program. And as the Secretary very eloquently indicated, we are facing another difficult six-year improvement program update for this 10 through 15 six-year period. After just reducing the highway program, and I continually speak about the latest $2 billion that we cut from the revised program, but we don't want to forget the billion that was cut prior to the original adoption of the 9 through 14. So we have reduced funding across all 6 years and by about $3 billion in 2008. We are facing some, again, potential revenue reductions that could reduce again the program as we know it. Those could both be from the state level and the federal level, because still at this point we don't know what our federal funding is going to look like in 10 forward. And as the Secretary also indicated, the sustainability of our six-year improvement program is in question, partly because the declining revenues has in fact reduced our ability to issue the total $3 billion in bonds authorized through House Bill 3202, and that was over an 11-year period. The declining insurance premium revenue is limiting our ability to issue the CPR bonds from the $3 billion authority level down to the $2.2 billion authority level. And I've talked about that before, and I want to talk in a little bit more detail. The original issuance time frame outlined in House Bill 3202 was fiscal year 08 to fiscal year 2018. We had the ability to spend incrementally or sell incrementally that $3 billion in authorization. We're now looking at not being able to sell even the first portion of that till June of 2010, though we do have bonds on projects back as far as 2008. And we will only, with the current revenue situation, be able to sell bonds in the near term between June of 2010 through 2016. And then we wouldn't have the authority to sell again out beyond, or looking in the realm of 2035, if our revenue picture stays as it currently stands. Now, to give you an idea of where we have our bonds in the program, you may recall the General Assembly approved the 2007 Transportation Initiative, where they identified approximately $500 million in general fund dollars for five different categories of projects, including rail projects, rail and transit, and transportation. In the 2008 timeframe, they changed a portion of those proceeds from cash to $180 million additional bonding authority in a similar structure to the CPR bonds or the House Bill 3202 bonds. So we have $180 million in bond authorization to be spent on the project list associated with that $500 million transportation initiative. We also have in the 9 through 14 revised program for VDOT about $600 million in bonds for matching federal dollars and a little bit on standalone projects of statewide significance. DRPT also has approximately $738 million in bonds for match and projects. And then we have $140 million in bonds for the revenue sharing program. So, as I've indicated before, we have approximately $1.6 to $1.7 billion in bonds already on project in the 9 through 14 program, and we haven't sold bonds yet.
So that means you programmed that money.
We've programmed
from the bonds
$1.6 billion over that time frame as allocations on projects to go forward.
Could you give us just an example, say a piece of roadway or a bridge that you have put bond funds on in the 6-year plan?
Any project in the 6-year program that qualifies for federal dollars mm-hmm. has bond money on it as a match up for that federal dollar draw.
But we have not sold those bonds.
That's
we
right.
just have the authority. But right now we don't have the revenue.
We don't have the, that's correct. We don't have the proceeds in the bank.
Ms. Connolly, there are two issues here. One is that the inability to sell the bonds as plans means that we are drawing down our cash reserves. And that's something we're not ready to get to that level of description, but that's a very, very important issue. The second thing for the board to understand is the original bond authorization that was estimated at $3 billion is a little more than two. And there's a strict hierarchy of use. Priority one is for rail and transit projects and associated match. So you see money going into the intercity rail projects. You see that going into Dulles Rail, Norfolk Light Rail, etc. The second priority is for federal match. And that's a very substantial, the 20% of the federal dollars. Again, as we have gotten so very constrained on state revenues, that is the only available source for that. And one of the questions to ask, and we're not ready to answer this, but it is an important question. If we had no bond proceeds, would we be able to fully draw down all federal revenues today? It's an open question, but one that we'll be attempting to answer in a more systematic way as this program develops. That is of particular concern because the bond authorization is smaller and does not last as long, and we do have a charge to develop constrained 20-year programs. That's a very, very significant issue. So that's the second draw on the bonds, transit and rail first, federal match second. Third is for the local revenue sharing program. And then the fourth is if there are any other projects, and at one time there were projects that were fully funded with bonds. I think those have all gone by the wayside. I would suggest for those of you who like and love the local revenue sharing program, that's probably something we will not be able to afford in the very near future. And that's simply all we are attempting to do is to find a way to match federal dollars at this juncture.
For us, the next component to consider with regard to sustainability of the program is the federal strategy. The six-year improvement program is VDOT and DRPT's allocation plan for projects and project phases over a six-year period. And every year, we must use all of our federal dollars or lose it. And it's redistributed to other states. So far, we've been able to use all our federal dollars. as the Secretary indicated with his question, can we continue to draw down available federal funding without additional resources other than debt? So in the development of the fiscal year 2010 through 2015 six-year improvement program, we have asked the district to review and identify available resources in previous allocations. And what I mean by that are allocations on projects or allocations from fiscal year 2009 back that's on projects that probably won't go forward or that is sitting there accumulating on a project that we can draw from to use that to fund federally qualifying projects to obligate all of our federal funds for federal fiscal year 2009. So we're actually going back beyond 2009 back to look at what money is sitting on projects that I could transfer to federally qualifying projects to draw down federal dollars for the current federal fiscal year strategy.
Let me, if I may, underscore the importance of this. For those of you who have been on the board for a while, you probably have a project or two that you have a little piggy bank, and every year you add to it. We will be emptying those piggy banks simply to keep the program afloat. Mr. Witt, your wish is coming true.
Mr. Chairman,
but
this, we have done some of this on a discrete basis from year to year, so it's not a new tactic. What you're saying is it becomes really a part
actually,
of the strategy.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Bush, but I don't think we've ever gone into prior allocations.
Even last year, or when we recently revised the 9-14 program, we did it 9 forward.
Gotcha.
So now we're going back beyond 9 previous.
Is there a guesstimate on how much that would represent?
I'm needing at this point about $300
million. And lots of projects.
Wow.
And is there any assurance that that money would ever be put back?
No, sir. Yeah,
it's probably the opposite.
I think if the money goes off the project disappears.
Well, good, Mr.
McCarthy.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Fisher, does anybody know, I know there's uncertainty about the federal program. I was at a briefing 2-3 weeks ago where Congressman Oberstar, I guess it is the chairman of the Transportation in the House, absolutely positively promised a transportation bill this year. He said in the 40-plus years he's been in the House, it's only happened on time twice. So it's probably not going to happen in all likelihood. But then someone else stood up and said, well, that's his opinion. And so I would second your concern about whether we're going to have a reauthorization bill in 2009. But if we did, will that alleviate or exacerbate, in your judgment, or your guesstimate, I guess, this particular question?
It will depend on the funding stream used for that reauthorization, because the current funding stream is on a declining track.
Would you
explain
that?
If I might embellish Ms. Bush's remark a little bit. The reauthorization is less important than patching the tire. If you recall, last September, I believe it was the 5th, Secretary Mary Peters called up Mr. Kendall was there and advised all of us that the Highway Trust Fund had run out of cash. And we faced a situation, this was the same weekend that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were essentially put into receivership by the Federal Reserve Board. And the underlying problem is that the expenditure commitments substantially exceed the ingoing revenues, to the tune of about 25%. And so Congress did act at Secretary Peters' request with an emergency patch, everybody thought was enough at the time, to get us through that the current federal fiscal year. Now it appears that that will not be enough. And so if you look at a new federal fiscal year beginning this September, the first question to ask is, will there be some type of general fund addition to allow current expenditure levels to continue. If not, we will see about a 20 to 25% reduction in federal transportation revenues overall. Those hit in different times and different percentages in different programs. But it all goes back, there is a BIRD Act at the federal level, which basically says you got to balance your revenues and your expenditures. It is a true pay-as-you-go program. The revenues are not there to support those expenditures. That is one of the reasons that Ms. Buescher and the commissioner have recommended and we adopted in the last update of the six-year program a revenue reserve to account for, we don't know.
If I might just clarify something, there I know there's the occasional misconception, what I refer to as the coffee shop misconception, of people who tell me, isn't it great we're getting $700 million in transportation funds? And it is. We're glad to have them. What they forget is that we cut $3.1 billion out of the program. So while we welcome $700 million, there's still $2.4 billion in projects and programs and people and services that are disappearing, at least for the time being, till we somehow deal with the revenue side of the equation. And now this is even worse if the federal share is going to be lower than it has been in the last 5 or 6 years appropriations period. So you're right, it's not a very pretty picture. But I want to make sure that I understand this and that people who are listening, who pay attention to this, know that the $700 million is welcome, but it is not a fix. Things are still heading downhill.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. So the districts are actively doing this now, reviewing and identifying the allocations that come back. By definition, that's probably not likely to result in a fair and balanced list, is it? In other words, it has nothing to do now with allocations by construction district or priorities that we may have set as a board or that localities may have set it as priorities. I was thinking, for example, of Prince William County, who's put a lot of its own county funds in, you know, expecting state funds to be able to match it as it goes. So we'll basically then sort of claw back money on a random basis. Let me add a question here. How are we to set priorities if that's the manner in which we're unsetting priorities? It's a conundrum, isn't it?
I think that will be a challenge over the coming months. And some of the issues that this body will face, there are still, for example, some federal funds that are allocated through formulas to urban and secondary. Can we continue that practice? We've taken all the state dollars out of that. You're absolutely right because of the historic nature. There are projects that have been accumulating funds for 10, 15 years and could be quite substantial. And there's not an easy answer. It will not be a fair process. It will be a process that gets to a balanced budget.
I have to admit, Mr. Chairman, I've stumbled upon an effective way to communicate with my local governments. As I say, I actually have your secondary road allocations in my wallet, right? And they understand that's a fairly discreet amount.
Mr. Chairman. I was going to wait till the end to make this comment, but I'd like to follow up with Mr. Colmey's comment. I have been saying, and I think we have reached the tipping point. As we go through this process, and we probably should talk about it today so that staff can begin to consider whatever the consensus of this group is, we should stop building new lane miles. We should just recognize we have a system in place, take what money we have to try to reverse this trend of deterioration of pavement from 18, 19, 21, 22%, put all our money towards existing bridges and ratchet up our repair and rehabilitation cycle on those, and let our localities know. There's not a new turn lane. There is not a new piece of right-of-way acquisition. There is not a new road. We only have money left to maintain and then try to keep it in good condition, be good stewards of what was built before us, and repair the existing highway system of Virginia. And just put a moratorium on any new projects and pull the money off of the projects that really haven't been started, and be caretakers of what we have, and end the charade of thinking we can add to lane miles in Virginia and keep growing and improving things, when in fact our revenue trends are continuing to go in the wrong direction, and there's nothing in sight that would indicate a change.
If I might respond, we actually have been trending very much in that direction for several years. So if you look at major projects such as Springfield Interchange, was actually a maintenance project. It started out with failing bridges. Woodrow Wilson Bridge falls into that category. The Gilmerton Bridge in Hanover. I mean, most major projects for many years, it's been a long time actually since there was a Greenfield highway project in Virginia. And so I think we need to be careful. But also, and my point here too, at the national level, there's a lot of discussion about the rhetoric and the psychology of the economy. And for us as a Commonwealth to say, well, golly, we have 18,500 new jobs at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, we're not going to do anything to help make that work, or we're not going to do anything to bring Cannon to Newport News, we can't make that statement. And so I think the tone and the rhetoric is very important in how we say these issues. Your point, very well taken, and I think if you stand back and look at the program, it in fact has been trending in that direction, not completely, but that's just a function of where we are as a Commonwealth. It's not just the funding, but you know, we have so many mature regions and the demands. Again, whether it's the Gilmerton Bridge or Woodrow Wilson Bridge, have been to maintain and perhaps expand what they have, you know, in place. But it's not necessarily what most of us would consider to be new capacity. Just my only note of caution is we cannot, in this climate, say that we are opposed to or not willing to find creative ways to provide infrastructure for economic growth. It's very, very important.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's a really good reason why that's true. If you look at the population figures for Virginia over the last 10 years, we grew by almost 1 million people, if I remember correctly. And we're projected to grow by another 1 million people. And to say we're going to stay right where we are doesn't make any good sense for anybody. It's not good public policy. It's not even possible. We're all going on the presupposition that there is no way to come up with any additional money to address these needs. And that's the foolhardiness of this whole discussion.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I think too that Dr. Davis hit on the nail on the head, and that's what we've got to put up front, this lack of revenue. And I think for some of us in this room, we even need to let that message out in our communities. We've tried now for 8 years. This situation that we're in, where we're laying off 1,000 people or at least eliminating 1,000 positions, would not have been as drastic as it is had we got the performance we requested from the legislature on revenue some 6 and 8 years ago. And while my good friend here's talking about reality, it's not a real good marketing plan, but it is somewhat a reality that we're gradually going that way. And so bringing about the first topic, and that is the revenue loss, because we haven't done away with any of the assets. We need to maintain the assets. It's not to get rid of the assets. We've got to maintain the assets. If the ballpark's there, the only way people are going to go into it if they can find a seat to sit down in. And that's the same way for our infrastructure and our roads. It's got to be maintained in such a way. And it is getting older. I think it was, who was it? Even George Bush said that more and more of our imports come from overseas. Well, you know, more and more of our infrastructure actually deteriorates over time. So I add that to this statement, too, and that's the obvious. So it's going to cost more money for maintenance. Therefore, we need revenues. We're talking about a shortage of revenues. Assets are there, and we've got to maintain them. But we get wrapped up in what the commissioner has to do, and that's give us deal with what pot of money he's got. But somebody's got to step up to the plate and use Jerry as an example. And I can tell you, you know, 10 cents a gallon only puts $100 for those on those that use 1,000 gallons a year. And they pay more for television. So there's part of our presentation is that enlighten and educate the public. They're not paying very much taxes on gasoline in the state of Virginia.
Mr. Chairman, I would say that Mr. Witt has the optimistic view of the future. because I'm serious, the situation is so penny-wise and pound-foolish right now that even to maintain what we have, as Mr. Keene pointed out, is an increasingly expensive proposition. But it is truly ridiculous from the public's point of view when in the small print, if you read the commissioner's proposal to us last month, when you get into reading the levels of service that are proposed under the fiscal constraints we are going to be stuck with if we don't find new revenue in the next year or so, potholes will not even be fixed within 4 or 5 days or so. And I can tell you my own pothole story if you want to take the time, but trust me, any individual driver will spend several years' worth of his gas tax expenditure for one pothole accident and scary situation than having that money available for a few cents a day to maintain the roads to a standard that we have been used to in Virginia. And we are, under his proposal, the commissioner's proposal, he is proposing to lower those standards, and that is becoming a safety issue for me as well as a cost to the public, because you're going to pay hundreds of dollars to fix flat tires and replace them versus, you know, a few cents more, $100 a year more in gas tax. I think that's penny wise and pound foolish. You don't think? Did I misstate something there? Because the way I read them, it looks like we're moving down from fixing potholes in a day or two down to 3 or 4 days' time.
I'll talk about this again in my blueprint update, but I want to and I want to address this because there is a misperception going on, and I don't know why that has occurred. But I want to be very clear. We are rebuilding this organization to be a maintenance and operations organization. When I committed to you last month that the area headquarters and fully staffing the area headquarters was the foundation of the VDOT of 2010, that was my commitment that emergency response, maintenance, and operations would be our first priority as originally stated by the Commonwealth and this board. We are not compromising emergency response. That is why I have proposed 5 services to be reduced: rest areas, mowing, the non-critical emergency response. I'm getting a lot of feedback around that around the Commonwealth, but we'll come back to that later this afternoon. It is to ensure that we have snow and ice service. What we showed the board last month was a system that we have had in place in this department for 60 years called our maintenance manual. Those standards are our performance standards. We exceed those standards all over the Commonwealth. And by building from our area headquarters, we are ensuring that those critical emergency response standards continue to be met and or exceeded. Now, to the long term, on the spiral we're on, could you get to that point, some point in the future? As I help the board set priorities, there are diminishing returns. I don't disagree with that. But your direction to me, the direction of the Secretary and Governor, has been to preserve that emergency snow and ice keep the Commonwealth functioning. And so while I sound a little bit passionate, I want to be absolutely clear with the employees of this department and the board that I work with on a day-to-day basis that I understand what our first priority is.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Webb.
Going back to Ms. Butcher's last bullet point on that slide, the looking back from the year 2009 backwards to reallocate funds, I view that as a positive exercise. I do, because we talked for several months about my concern that we needed a new model in this day of declining revenues, and we're faced with a gubernatorial election coming up, and it's hard for me to believe that any statewide candidate is going to run on a platform of increasing taxes. That may occur, but it's not likely in my view, particularly with the economy being the way it is. So the new model may be unfolding before us as we look back from 2009 and face the realities of declining revenues. And so I'm actually looking forward to that because there are a number of projects that have sort of languished in the six-year plan in my district that, quite frankly, don't make any sense anymore. And having the opportunity to go back and look at those and reach a conclusion where we can look a locality in the eye and say that's no longer there and here's why, and there's a valid reason for it, I think it's a healthy exercise.
Thank you, Mr. West. Any other comments? We're actually had what was scheduled to be the last item on the agenda, which is future direction for the board. I think we've covered that in large measure. Thank you for these great comments, and I do think, and I want to thank Ms. Buescher for, you know, putting this forward in a clear, understandable way. I don't think anyone, certainly most of our stakeholders, appreciate the challenges that's being faced by transportation finance. But if we don't have a sustainable program and we are unable to do the things that we are statutorily charged with, we have to make some not only difficult choices, but I think some very substantial recommendations. We have to do something different. And no one knows what that is, and that's what we're going to be talking about for the next 2-3 months.
I would like to turn the podium over to Mr. Pitter.
I bet you would. Welcome, Mr. Pitter.
Thanks, Rita. Board Chairman, I just wanted to touch base, add on to Rita's presentation, the impacts of the six-year planning process we're about to embark on the next few months. With respect to rail and transit. A few items that I think y'all should consider. Obviously, we've ad nauseum talked about the revenues being down. But one impact, as Rita said, you know, we have projects out there that have bonds allocated to them. And there's a cash flow issue involved there, which is having an impact on the balance with which we earn interest. So that's a further reduction in the funds that are going to be available for us to distribute in our formula and capital programs, the 10 program. For instance, I guess in 2008, we earned about $5 million of interest on our mass transit trust fund balances. And for fiscal year 10, the estimate that we have currently is about $1.2 million. So it's a significant number drop-off that we're looking at there. Another item, we've actually received applications in February 1st, and looking at those, we have noticed about a 20% decline in the number of capital applications. And in particular, you've seen this in the rural providers, that they don't have the funds necessarily to come up with their local match. So although they're getting fewer applications, it's not necessarily a positive. It's because the local revenues are down and they don't have the local revenues to provide that amount of match to our funds. Another item, as Mr. Director Badger had spoken about earlier, we will be coming back in April, looking for y'all approval for the capital projects for both our rural program and our small urban program, the governor's apportionment, due to federal stimulus deadlines. We have to move that up from the normal June approval. And finally, I think what we'll see this year is, I think the maturation, what I call the maturation of the rail enhancement fund, where we actually truly have a six-year program, where we've actually gone into more further refinement of the project within each quarter. Also, I want to, Ms. Buescher talked a lot about the bonds and the reduction in capacity, and a little bit about cash flow. So I wanted to touch on that a little bit also. You know, y'all have seen the rail resource allocation plan, and we have a draft statewide rail plan out there. And in that program, in that plan, both of those plans, we had anticipated $129 million of the bonds that would be available for rail. And now that we're gone from about a $3 billion capacity to about 2.2 based on the actual revenues, we're looking at 2 years of our bonds that we would have allocations for not being there. So that number, $129 million, we're looking at about $26 million on that number. Because the last 2 years, we won't actually have the capacity to issue bonds under the current revenue forecast. Also, the revenues for the Rail Enhancement Fund, vehicle rental taxes, they're down also. So the work we did just 10 months ago was based on a revenue level of here, and that revenue level has diminished, which in essence is going to mean some of those rail projects are going to take longer to actually complete to get the revenues in. It will take longer time here. Another issue is actually having the cash available in hand. You know, in fiscal year 08 and in 09, we allocated numerous dollars to bond projects, one of which was we put $125 million towards the Dulles Metro Rail project. That amount of money by our contract with the airports authorities coming due to them. And essentially the way we're going to pay for it is VDOT is going to loan us the funds, which in turn shifts that cash flow issue to VDOT because obviously we have not issued bonds. For us, we also have $80 million of transit grants that have been made in 08, and then $20 million in 08, $16 million in 09, which we have agreements with providers, and those buses are starting to get delivered now. Providers are looking to us to reimburse them. And currently what we're doing is we're making interfund loans to be able to pay those amounts. But very important that the bonds get issued. I think we have referenced next May or June time frame. So the next 15 months from a cash perspective is going to be a bumpy road for both VDOT and us from a cash perspective. The final item is the general fund earmarks that were funded, that were replacement funded with bonds. We're also looking at $60 million worth of those earmarks for fiscal year 10 that we'll need to figure out how to fund. And finally, the last item I wanted to kind of touch on was just the long-term sustainability of the capital program. And I know there's been a lot of, I guess if there is positive, so to speak, it's been the rail and the transit programs and sustaining the bond. And I guess this point is really looking out at a longer-term perspective that really the capacity of those bonds is down from $3 billion to $2.2 billion. And when we get out to 2016, I think the next two slides will show you where I'm headed. First, we have a slide that shows without general fund earmarks and without the bonds where our capital match would be, which is the blue line, the lower line. And you see sort of the spikes up and down. And then now we have these bonds in the next slide. You'll see for the next 4 or 5 years, we have these bonds that 60% relative capital match, whereas those bonds go away, we're down to around a 20% capital match, which is basically lowest in program history. So the point I'm trying to leave you with, we get to 2016, we're right back to lowest in program history. So I think we've got to be thinking about that maintenance first as a priority, you know, with our program also. It's, it might seem like it's a few years away, but it's not that far away. And finally, the last slide is to kind of give you all an overview of the schedule we're going to be following over the next several months to get the program adopted. Obviously, VDOT is in the process of working through projects with their districts. We've gotten applications in as of February 1. We're in the process of putting together a draft program. Both VDOT and us will be coming to y'all for supplemental approvals, amendments due to the federal stimulus requirements and deadlines. So it's going to be a little bit of an unusual year in that respect. Then we're looking at May to actually present and publish a draft program and follow that up with hopefully getting an approval, required to get an adopted program in June before June 30th each year. That concludes the presentation. If there's questions, we'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Pitter. Questions?
Mr. Chairman, Steve and Rita, how fast will the districts complete their review of Project this, and could we, for example, expect to be able to see a working list? Okay. So we would expect, and we expect to have that ready for us to take action by the middle of next month? One at our next meeting, or? Okay, gotcha. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions or comments for Ms. Buescher or Ms. Pitter? Thank you both for a cheery and chipper presentation. We look forward to the development of the next program and our ongoing discussions. The next item on the agenda, we do not have a handout, but as you know, the commissioner has been around the state about halfway through 12 public hearings around the Commonwealth on the blueprint. And I will say by way of introduction, and I think echoing some of the remarks that other board members have made, when we're laying off 1,000 full-time and 500 part-time employees and canceling $3 billion worth of projects, the attention is understandable from the general public. They tend to focus on what they read and hear, but what they read and hear is what is focused in the media and through, I think, a less than enlightened leadership, asking questions about the least important aspects of what's happening in transportation and our infrastructure. So to hear from the front lines, Commissioner Eckern's here to give us an update. But again, remember the three legs of the stool, which is program, services, and staffing. Welcome, Commissioner.
Mr. Secretary, thank you. And Mr. McCarthy, I need to thank you again for raising the question, because it's a great intro into what we're doing with the other two parts of the blueprint. Initially, when the Secretary and I talked a little bit earlier, I'm not one who likes to discuss the game in the middle of the innings. And because we had committed to a transparent process of getting public input around several aspects of the forward plan for responding to the economic downturn, when he and I first discussed this, I sent him a couple of notes and just said, you know, it's not really fair to all the inputters that after the fourth inning, I give the score of the ball game just yet. But I think it is appropriate that we spend some time and get you updated, because in the last 2 weeks, I have listened to somewhere around 800 to 850 citizens of the Commonwealth. In the process of doing that, as I've been about the state, I've met on, if I got my count about right, two chambers, an MPO, and a variety of employee groups throughout the department. answering questions and laying out the dynamics of what is engaged in what is the singular largest undertaking at focusing and restructuring the department, probably in the last 20 years. And I want to take the parts this way. I'd like to give you just a brief update on what we are doing internally as we start to detail the elements of the blueprint that I have laid out to the board from October to December and again in February as we announced and started. There is a tremendous amount of activity going on. And any time you open the windows to the organizational workings of the department, where it is relatively taken for granted across the Commonwealth, all the work that goes into the mechanics of making an organization successful, as I talked about a little bit earlier this afternoon, you run the risk of people not understanding how the business works. This February, when I showed you our maintenance manuals and how that works, those are the mechanics of how we do business within the department. And so that's an important aspect of how we put the organization and structure it coming into July 2010, recognizing an organizational size of 7,500 classified employees. Not an easy task. The largest impact of the restructuring is being felt in our construction and program development areas of the department. That's a direct relationship to the reduction in the program decisions that you've had to make over the last year and a half. I cannot stand in front of you or the taxpayers of this Commonwealth and explain why we have reduced the program a third, and I still have a staff devoted to being able to develop and deliver a program that is a third larger than it really is. That's the cold, hard dilemma that my staff and I are working through right now. So the biggest bulk of the discussion that we are detailing now deals with how many people where, dealing with project development, right-of-way acquisition, environmental processing, location and design work, all of those activities that you're familiar with that go on in any given district. Construction inspection, construction management. So we are meeting with employees throughout the department talking about how that process works. Because how you design an organization and how you treat your people are two key elements of this structure work that we're doing moving into July of 2020. We have put and are focusing, as I just indicated in response to Mr. McCarthy, as we structure our organization for the future, our core will be around our maintenance and operations activities. That will, I expect, to be somewhere between 60% to 65% of the entire focus of the department's staff. That's why we have established as a foundational point the first building block, which is the area headquarters. That is the location, the 189 locations that we consolidated to in 2006. Those are the launch points for all staff response to snow and ice, to pothole filling, to all of the services that are critical to everyday life in the Commonwealth. That is led by a superintendent. And that then will report through a residency structure and to a maintenance engineer and then the district administrator. That's very clear. It's very straightforward. It's intended to be that way to streamline the chain of command. That's a critical piece of emergency response. last year when this board asked that we focus at our Springfield Interchange event, we introduced new techniques into the department. We established what we call a duty officer. 24/7, 365 days a year, we have staff identified that are the key contact points for situational awareness when there is an issue facing the department anywhere in the state. We introduced and put in place an aggressive anti-icing program. We invested in the equipment and the materials that our staff needed across the state to be able to enhance the time that we can have to respond to snow and ice events. That's a statewide initiative. No other state has ever tried to do that on a statewide basis. It's been extremely successful, in my view. I am getting good, positive feedback from our staff that says this works. The third piece that we put in place was what we call our TERRY Institute, Transportation Emergency Response Institute. Comprehensive 5-day training for duty officers, for staff, to ensure that we could stabilize our mobilization strategies for winter snow and ice. So I'm willing to take some criticism, and I've gotten a couple of emails this year about we mobilized for a particular event, and I got a couple of emails that said, why did you have trucks up? Because we were ready, and that's important. It wasn't reactive. That came from the staff of the department. That's a strong message in my view. So as we now rebuild the organization, we will fully staff area headquarters that today are not as staffed as fully as they could be because we've been getting ready to restructure. That's why I've asked the chief deputy to hold all vacancies. That's why we have a critical hire process going on so that we don't inadvertently fill wrong positions in wrong places to have the effect of not being able to respond. Now we're starting into that process that as we move forward, those will create opportunities for employees in the department. That's why this restructuring piece is being detailed now by our stage leaders, and we will get into the hard work of the personnel processes that have to go on. I can tell you on the internal side and on the personnel side, last September when we briefed you, we were staffed with 8,464 employees in total, classified employees in the department. Today we are at about 8,296. So people are continuing to retire or otherwise find a tripe, as you call it, from the department. So the direction that the governor established is a direction that we are balancing as a part of this restructuring activity. We have briefed the General Assembly and have validated in budget language that the goals that are in the blueprint are valid. So we think we've done the appropriate vetting on the internal organizational side so that people are aware of where we're headed. The interface now gets to the services part of our program, which we briefed on and have now taken out to the second piece, or the third part of the blueprint, which is you've done hard work. You've accommodated $2 billion of reductions in the program. My job, working with department staff, is to find $600 million in operations and services that we provide as savings going over the next 6 years. We will have savings because of a reduced staffing in the department. But we have identified $50 million of potential annual savings in service reductions to complement the staffing changes that will occur. We are getting spirited feedback on those five options that we have in front of the public. As a quick reminder, they are partial closure of our rest area system, 25 rest areas being closed. We have proposed a reduction in our safety service patrol coverage areas. We will and are working with our interstate maintenance for contractors that cover 13 segments of the interstate system to re-scope those contracts with a primary focus on exactly what I'm asking area headquarters people to do, which is emergency response and core maintenance routine services, pothole filling, those important issues. Third area that we have laid out, or fourth area, I guess, that we have laid out for comment is our mowing practices across the Commonwealth, which would save approximately $20 million annually. And we have laid out our ferry services. We have four ferry services that we maintain. Last night, we held the first hearing on the Jamestown-Scotsland ferry service. The feedback we are getting is strong, it is targeted, and it really does reinforce the importance of all of those services that we are providing throughout the Commonwealth. And the public's reluctance to give those services up. Rest areas have dominated the western part of the state. Last night, ferry services dominated the discussion. I'm eager to hear what we will hear in other...
Mr. Chairman, he didn't mind me interrupting. I don't think that a single person has agreed with the idea of closing the rest stop. I haven't talked to a single person who believes that's a good idea. And I'm included in that.
We await constructive alternatives.
So,
I might add, Mr. Davis, you know, after hearing the litany of safety service patrol, is a rest area more important than a safety service patrol?
If you ride Interstate 81, it is. And
we're going to have that conversation. But
we have to make tough choices, I understand.
Yes, I
can tell you the general public does not believe that for safety reasons we can close those rest stops, and I agree with them 100%. And if you can look at a lot of reasons. You may call them a convenience. They're not convenient. They're for safety as the number one consideration. And the first time a trucker who can't stop hits a car, kills three or four kids.
Hold on, right there, Mr. Davis. Truck parking is a separate issue from rest areas.
It is. Big issue, but there's far more issues related than trucks. But that one area alone gives me great pause. And I will work with you to try to find alternative revenues to keep those open. And if we have to close some of them, so be it. But if we should not do it without knowing that we're creating a nightmare in doing so. And everybody that spoke in my district, 300 and some people were there, every one of them, women who travel the road at night by themselves, families with children, family with pets, truck drivers, you go down the list. It was unanimous that we need to keep those rest areas open. Now, some of them are fairly close, and I recognize that. They're 30 miles apart, a few of them are. And there could be some adjustments, but the idea of closing 11 of those stops on 81 is, to me, just totally unacceptable. And I will work with you to try to find some revenues to make that work. I don't know where they'll come from, but it's like many other considerations that we're faced with.
Thank you.
And, you know, the residencies, we heard a lot about the residencies, and, I mean, we spent a lot of time together, which was good for me and I think hopefully good for the commission as well. We didn't hear nearly as much there. We heard a lot of praise for VDOT workers and for the staff throughout all of that. Ordinary citizens stand up saying, we believe VDOT employees do a great job. We're proud of what's happening. They didn't understand the difference between the services that will be provided from the residencies and headquarters. And a lot of them believed that we were not going to plow their roads. And we had entire members of the Board of Supervisors from two or three counties. Entire boards were there.
saying, you've got to plow our roads in the wintertime. Well, where that came from, I still haven't figured out exactly until one of them showed me a copy of the manual that we have for plowing roads that are rated 4 or 5. It does indicate that it's possible some of those won't be plowed at all, and some will be plowed on a 2-day or 3-day basis. Now, we told them 4 or 5 times in the hearing, we're going to plow those roads the way we have in the past. There's not going to be a change in service. But they didn't believe us. And they don't understand right now. So we've got a lot of work to do, and I include my own role in this, to help educate them to that fact. And we had legislators stand up in that hearing and mislead the public because they were uninformed I'm going to state my words carefully here, or did not want to tell the public what the truth was. And as a result, it was almost like a cheerleading event. And that's wrong because we have to do a lot more, I think, to educate more of the public about what is going down here. We will have huge discontent about VDOT that I don't think is fair, and most people don't think is fair. I could go on, but it was a very educational experience to sit there for 4.5 hours, and I hope the rest of you get your opportunity to hear similar comments. You don't have many of you don't have an 81 running through your district, but you'll hear plenty, and a lot of it's out of confusion, and I'd like to support the commissioner on getting that confusion cleared up and seeing if we can make sure those supervisors and elected officials that we let go first in the presentation, and there were 40 or 50 of them there, which was very positive, but they went away misunderstanding still what this is all about.
And I'm going to show a little bit of my color here, too, if you'll pardon us, Commissioner, but there are areas of the Commonwealth due to congestion that may be hours before you can get to a rest area at certain times of the day. If you look at pavement standards, for whatever reason, there is not a fair distribution of pain with respect to pavement conditions. And so I think one of the things as we factor into a lot of these discussions, it's not just about downsizing and economizing, it is getting to a better degree of fairness. And that has to be a very, very important part of these budget discussions as we make choices, because in one area of the state, a safety service patrol may be more important than another, for example.
Just two more brief comments, if you don't mind. Yes, sir. Regionalism was a huge issue in this hearing, and it was fueled by legislators believing that their money was being taken somewhere else. And that's gone on for a long time, and even in my legislative days, I had to deal with that a lot. But again, we need to do some put out some facts and information for people that show that that is reality to a certain extent, that there, where the greater population centers are, more money will go. But the thing that I was thinking that we have to be so careful with after sitting through that 4.5 hours is not to spend our time talking to the public about reducing by 1,000 employees, all the steps we're taking administratively. What we have to talk to them about is service. They don't care what all we do to balance the budget, unfortunately. We do, and people have to make that decision, worry about that. I was an administrator for 40 years. I worried about that all the time, but most of my constituents didn't worry about how I balanced the budget. They wanted it balanced, and they wanted their services. So if we can work hard to keep our focus on the services that are going to be there, are going to be missing, I think we'll be better off than spending a lot of time explaining to them all the sacrifice that we're making administratively to try to deal with these services. That's just a comment, hopefully, that we can all use as a guide.
But again, and your point is well taken, it's also important to understand that the service the citizen sees is the tip of the iceberg, and most of it is beneath the water, and it's the hardworking people within the agency, the infrastructure, the technology that allows that service to occur. And it is our responsibility to educate the public about that. Many of those things we can't have without people in the district or the central office to do procurement and contract oversight or to run the computers 24/7. Just those, and we will never be able to fully educate the public on that, and that's the reason for this body to have these debates and come to some very difficult conclusions. Mr. Whitten, then Commissioner, we're intruding on your time.
Mr. Chairman, I know that our debate is for another day, so my comment is just to set the stage for the dialogue that we can have going forward. I had a delightful time at the public hearing in Dendron, Virginia last night, and prior to going into that, I really thought that cutting ferry service over evening hours was no big deal. I walked out of there 3 hours later, prepared to close all the rest areas in Virginia to allow a reduction in the ferry service at Jamestown Scott. So
you live on the other side of the river.
We have a debate in front of us.
Yes, we do. And things that are necessities. And at the right moment, a bathroom is a necessity. If you're trying to get to work or to school or to a hospital, a ferry boat is a necessity. If you've lost a tire and a pothole on the Beltway, a safety service patrol is a necessity. Commissioner, forgive us.
Quite all right, Mr. Secretary, members.
Just getting warmed up here.
You know, I want to compliment this board and the secretary for having this debate, because it is exactly what I have been talking to the citizens about in each of these meetings, about our commitment to a transparent way of doing business. I can tell you the level of discussion that is going on in this state around this basic service model and what we do as an organization is more open and transparent than any state I have worked in. And there is more enthusiasm for that discussion than I have experienced in my 40 years in this business in the last 2 weeks. That's a good thing, very frankly. And as I remind everyone, at the end of the day, this is a professionally driven plan. It is not perfect. I can tell you that in the first four sessions, with the hard work that you have been doing, I can identify two or three changes that will probably occur based on good fundamental business models as a result of that input. That's a good thing. That is a positive coming out of these kinds of hearings. It takes you overnight think about some of these things as you hear the enthusiasm, the ardor, the real commitment people have to needing and wanting those services. So on that respect, I think it is very doable in the next 8 weeks for us to craft the right adjustments to the plan as we move forward. My staff is working hard and committed to making the adjustments we need to make in our business practices as we focus the department, focus missions. People are having to change, and as I meet with employees, they're willing to do that. They're willing to take on those different challenges because that's their commitment to the business. As a piece of confidence for you, as employees talk to you, what I do for them is contrast our process against what they may have been. I'm absolutely amazed at the number of our employees that have private sector experience and what they experience in similar situations in the private sector. And I think they walk away with a higher degree of confidence and trust, knowing that there is the process and the transparency that we're using as how it will affect their professional lives and their personal lives. And I think that's a positive, very frankly, in this time of real stress across the organization. The Secretary and I have agreed that we will continue these monthly updates throughout the transition process. Because I think it's absolutely critical, and as we move into the May time frame, and as you adopt our fiscal year 10 budget, I think that will be the right time to make those trade-offs that we're hearing about as we move into fiscal year 10. I'll be glad to answer any additional questions that the board may have. And I have no problem continuing this discussion. I think it's very healthy. Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Any other questions or comments? Obviously, our work is cut out for us, and I appreciate, Commissioner, your willingness to go out and face the public. That's not easy, and I would say it's unique among agencies. It is also unique that this agency elicits hundreds of people at agency turnouts. And one of the things, just as I mentioned, there's a tip of an iceberg. Once people see and understand how deep the problems are, hopefully they get to a better understanding about the needs to maintain our infrastructure. So,
Mr. Chairman, one other thing that came out of the hearing that I think the entire board should hear probably was a great surprise on the part of the general public that we could not privatize some of these rest areas. And I wonder if it would be helpful, I'd certainly like you to take under advisement your recommendation to us, a resolution to our congressional delegation asking for more flexibility in dealing with that issue, because I believe we could privatize those essential areas on the interstates and not have to spend the money. I believe they would generate sufficient funds to take care of the primary ones. I think some of the secondary ones would still be a problem, most likely. But if you would so advise, I would be happy to ask my colleagues to support a resolution to our congressional delegation asking them to please try to free up some flexibility for us to privatize those rest areas.
I will say we tried twice in the last two reauthorization bills to do just that. And you would be amazed, the truck stop lobby every 5 to 6 years rises up and is a very powerful force to be reckoned with. A resolution to the governor would be appropriate so that he could take that under advisement as to whether or not to communicate to the congressional delegation. I feel certain he would be supportive of
that. I'd rather do it informally unless you'd like a formal motion.
Well, we can write something up. Let's do that, if we may, under new business at the action agenda. Good idea. Okay, let's take a short 5-minute break, and then we'll come back and finish up the work session. Thank you. For the rest area. Okay, the next item on our agenda is a location study on the Bridgewater Bypass. In light of the previous discussion, so we may not be seeing a whole lot of other presentations like this, so enjoy this one for the historical aspects of it. I'll also say, in view of the ongoing dialogue today and the lateness of the hour, unless there's a compelling need for us to dive in on item 8, I think there's going to be a lot of meat in the V-Trans presentations, and I think by the time we're done with that, we will probably be out of the collective gas. Welcome, Mr. Walsh.
Good afternoon. Perhaps we can all apply for an AIG bonus, and all our problems would be gone.
I know you're out there. I can hear you breathing.
Yeah, I'll tell you later. The Bridgewater Bypass Location Study, just going to give you a little overview, project history, purpose and need, description, its potential impacts, our recommendation, and next steps. As far as the project history is concerned, it has been included in local and regional plans. VDOT initiated the location study in 2007, and FHWA signed an environmental assessment in December of 2007. A public hearing was conducted in January of 2008, 104 persons in attendance, numerous comments received via email, letters, and verbally. The town of Bridgewater passed a resolution in February 2008 supporting candidate build alternative A. It's our understanding that Rockingham County will be meeting next week, and we believe they will also be endorsing candidate build alternative A. The local MPO has also amended its constrained long-range plan to put the bypass into its constrained long-range plan for PE and right-of-way. The purpose and need is to provide an alternative route for traffic, especially truck traffic. It would remove vehicles out of downtown Bridgewater, improve mobility in the area, divert through traffic, although not a great deal of through traffic, reduce conflicts between vehicles, pedestrians, and bicycle travel on several roads in the town of Bridgewater, also reducing conflicts with turning movements. Now, you need to understand, in the Bridgewater area, most of the traffic moves in a north-south direction on Route 42 and Route 11. This bypass is more of an east-to-northwest bypass, so it doesn't pick up a lot of the movement coming on Route 42 from the south. At the same time, however, there is a large amount of truck traffic on Dinkle Avenue, and Dinkle Avenue goes right through the middle of Bridgewater College. There's a retirement community as well as a primary school, so there's a lot of pedestrians, you know, a lot of pedestrian traffic as well as bicycle traffic in an area that presently has some heavy truck traffic. As far as the project description, it runs, it's an east-north lane connecting Route 257 east of the town with Route 257, 42 north of the town. It's proposed as a controlled access, basically a limited access, four-lane divided highway. Presently would have three intersections, one at each end and one basically in the middle at Route 704. It is a new location. And the preliminary cost estimates, and this is 2015 dollars based on that assumed advertisement, would be $61 million for A and $57 million for Candidateville B. Here is a picture depicting the two candidate build alternatives. As you can see, they go along the same alignment for almost half of the distance, and then they split off with A being the more southern alignment. As far as a summary of potential impacts, this chart here lays out as far as the number of residences, displaced businesses, streams disturbed, wetlands, forest, farmland. But understand, these impacts are based on a planning corridor of 500 feet. The actual build corridor will probably be somewhere in the neighborhood of 140 to 150 feet. So these impacts should be lessened somewhat with the final design. Our recommendation, which will be coming to the board next month, is for the board to approve the location of Candidate Build Alternative A. Again, that is the alternative that the town has endorsed, the one we believe that Rockingham County will endorse. It does meet the purpose and need of the project. This does impact a rather large farm that has several historic structures on it. That farmer personally would like to no-build, but says if you're going to build an alternative, please go with Alternative A because that hugs the edge of the property, whereas Candidate Build Alternative B would cut the farm in half, basically. So the next steps would be coming to the board for a location decision next month. We'll do a revised EA based on the board's decision, submit that to the Federal Highway Administration with an anticipated FONSI sometime in the next several months. Now, you may ask, based on the discussion we've had already and the expense of this, why go forward, and I'll say two primary reasons. One, it does end one of the processes of moving a project forward. It will bring the federal environmental process to a conclusion, so we will have finished that. And secondly, it's our understanding that the county, this area has been in Rockingham County's growth area since 1977. So while a lot of it is farmland today, the growth pattern is to have growth in this area, and the county believes that part of that development there may be potential properties of roadway improvement, particularly building portions of this bypass as part of that development. So we will be here next month asking you to approve that location, and I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Mr. Chairman, after the light of the other discussion, it's kind of hard to say much here, but if the Rockingham County Board approves this, I would highly recommend that we proceed to get them to the phase of completing the environmental and to allow the town and the county, as they plan for the longer-term future, to be able to site this road so that in better days, perhaps, it really could be built. There's very little, if any, opposition to it. And Phil Stone, I think, was one of the originators of working with the group on this.
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chairman, as a strictly matter of curiosity, on slide 7, when I saw one of these regarding, I think, the Manassas Parkway or something, there was a category in here. I think there was one for minority displacement and another for low-income displacement. Is that missing from here because it's no longer an impact category, or just there are none in this area?
There are none in the area.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, do you know what position Bridgewater College has taken as to preferring Route A or Route B?
I have a letter. It came in after the close of the public comment session, but there was a letter submitted by Dr. Stone on behalf of Bridgewater in support of that.
A. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I know some of us received an email about this just today that seemed to say that the relief in traffic congestion and so forth, as you outlined it, actually wasn't the case. You know, it's very difficult for us to sort of question a study like you've done in a public hearing process that's brought something all the way forward, but is that just a misrepresentation of what you found, or is there a legitimate, difference of interpretation of the data?
I didn't receive the email, so I'm not sure where it's coming, but as I mentioned on this slide, if you look at Bridgewater, if you look at this area, the primary traffic movement is north-south.
Yes.
Route 42 and Route 11. Mm-hmm. They run basically parallel in 81 a little further to the east. And so you've got truck traffic and other vehicular traffic coming south on 40, going north on 42 coming from the south that probably won't use this bypass.
Right.
So the percentage of traffic that is going to be diverted is not as high. I want to say it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 30% of traffic today that will be diverted. But at the same time, it does take truck traffic off of Dinkle, which is an east-west route. That goes through the middle, through Bridgewater College, by this primary school, and by this retirement community. So it does help as far as safety in that particular area, getting trucks out of that area and moving them onto the bypass.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, do you have any statistics? You say heavy truck traffic, and you're talking about the traffic on 42. What's the traffic count? What are we talking about?
We do have counts, and we have both AM and PM peak, and I want to say the AM peak is a lot heavier than the PM. On 42, which is Main Street, north of downtown Bridgewater, you've got Marshalls and you've got Purdue, two major manufacturers that generate a lot of truck traffic. And then further up towards the town of Dayton, you have Cargill, which is, I guess, either the first or second largest employer in the area. And so there's a lot of truck traffic on that Route 42 today. I can get you the actual truck counts. It's less than 100 trucks in the peak period.
What's total count?
Nick, you know the total truck traffic? 4% of the total traffic.
Okay. Total traffic counts, what are we talking about? Are we talking 10,000 a day, 30,000 a day? What are we talking about?
It ranges between...
Yeah. Can you come up and introduce yourself, please?
My name is Nicholas Neitz. I'm the project manager. It ranges between, I want to say, 7,100 to 8,500 per day, but I can give you the exact figures.
Okay, and the bypass is going to divert about 30% of that?
It'll divert 25-35% of that. And generally, the analysis shows that predominantly it will divert truck traffic.
So what is the traffic count that you're projecting to be on the bypass? You said 30% of 7,100?
It would be better if I got you to do it.
It doesn't rise to the standards of
Suffolk, but it's important to the people of Bridgewater and Nottingham County.
I understand that. I understand that. Is it as important as your rest stop?
That's right.
That will be the critical question. Were there any other questions?
Just a quick observation on this email thing. That's probably worth following through. Any one of us would be happy to send it to you if you just sent us a note, because it was referring to an Appendix D of a noise study conducted for VDOT that the traffic counts there showed them going up rather than down. And so they were saying, why would that be the case? Why would you proceed? Well, I don't know if that's accurate or not, but I think look into it.
It's like the sand going through an hourglass. I mean, if you take traffic off the route, other traffic will eventually fill in. What they're saying is that on Dinkle and one other, I want to say...
Main Street,
that the traffic that is going to be diverted, that eventually it will build back up again, even with the bypass.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? I'm sure Mr. Walton will get back to you with any appropriate responses to your questions. This will be on the action agenda next month. Okay, the final item on our work session, second to last item, is V-Trans update. We have two presentations on the future of our principal revenue base in transportation, that is the motor fuels tax. Deputy Secretary Ralph Davis and Amy O'Leary from the Research Council will walk us through that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Presentation, I did want to share some good news with you. The Commissioner mentioned the Highway Safety Challenge. In actuality, our fatalities are down again this year. Through yesterday, the number of fatalities were 116. This is 61 less than the same time last year, a reduction of 34%. So amidst all of the gloomy news that you have, there is some good news, and that is that the fatalities are down significantly.
And Mr. Chairman, that was down from, certainly 08 was down from our trend lines.
That is
so right. This is a major.
This is major to have 60 less fatalities over basically 2.5 months, less than the previous year. It's major. I guess my comment on that, in looking at where the fatalities are, it maybe it's not a good comparison, but it reminds me of looking at what's happened to the major stocks of major companies. They're all negative, double-digit negatives. And you look down where the fatalities are, whether it's on the interstate or whether it's cars, motorcycles, and so forth, you see that it's normally down double-digit percent. So it's kind of down throughout the whole array of types of fatalities and causes and so forth. So it is very good news. Mr. Chair, back to the agenda. The agenda deals with the viability of the tax on gasoline, flat tax on gasoline. As we look at the Long Range Transportation Plan, one of the things we wanted to look at is whether or not the flat tax on gasoline is a viable tax, a viable source of revenues. We asked the Transportation Research Council to take a look at this. Dr. O'Leary at the council will report on the results of that study. He's done a very extensive study as well as a very extensive library, looking at what other states have done, what other studies show, and so forth. And this afternoon, she's going to condense her 60-page study into 11-page PowerPoint. So it's a lot of work that's gone behind that with Dr. O'Leary and her colleagues at the council. After her presentation, I will come up and provide another presentation, which is it's a short-term option to the vehicle mileage tax. I've been thinking about this for a while. Some of what you're going to find is that there are lots of difficulties with trying to implement a mileage tax. And so the question is, how do we deal with those difficulties? And so following Dr. O'Leary's presentation, it's a concept and option for our consideration and discussion on the vehicle miles tax. With those comments, Dr. O'Leary from the council.
Welcome, Dr. O'Leary.
The co-authors on this paper were Jim Gillespie, who is not here today, and Audrey Maruza from the Research Council, who is here. Our study purpose, as Mr. Davis mentioned, was to examine the long-term viability of the fuels tax and its alternatives. And the long-term term is important because it helps to explain why some things we may say are different than things you've been hearing recently. And in doing that, we were asked to look at state and national studies of the fuels tax, the state of Oregon's pilot DMT fee program, sales trends for hybrid and alternate fuel vehicles, trends in fuel efficiency and taxable gallons sold, and ultimately the viability of a vehicle miles of travel fee for Virginia. And just in case you're not familiar with it, a vehicle miles of travel fee would be a totally different way to finance transportation. It's being talked about some in the press, but instead of, say, paying 17.5 cents for every gallon of gasoline you purchased in Virginia, you might pay the state of Virginia 1 cent for every mile you drove within its boundaries. But in order to do that, there are some technological requirements. The car's got to be outfitted with a global positioning system unit and an onboard computer. It's going to calculate distances between boundaries and save those, and then it's got to have some kind of a communications link so that it can download that data to whatever computer is going to calculate your bill. So chances are if you're driving around in a 15-year-old car, that's not going to happen. It could perhaps be done for newer cars, as I'll talk about. Happily for us, there were lots of studies already out there, and that was really our job, was to review all of them. The state of Colorado had a Blue Ribbon Task Force that did a very large study of revenue options for them because their situation is not unlike Virginia's, and they were looking at it before the recession. There have been not one but two national study commissions. There was a 15-state pooled fund study of VMT fees completed in 2004. There was a Transportation Research Board study that looked at the feasibility, long-term feasibility of the fuels tax. There was the Oregon program, and there's an ongoing study out of the University of Iowa that's looking at sort of driver acceptance of the VMT fees at a number of different pilot locations, one of which is Research Triangle, North Carolina, and one of which is going to be Baltimore. I don't think the findings of the previous studies would surprise you. They all found that significant increases in transportation investment are needed now. These studies are a couple of years old, as I mentioned, so they don't necessarily reflect the state of the economy in the last, 12 months. But the experts thought that the fuels tax would be a viable revenue source until at least 2025. Viable, but not necessarily at a level to reduce congestion. All of them said the uncertainty after 2025 certainly warrants looking at alternatives now. But as they said that, they sort of realized that changing to a totally different method for financing transportation would involve enormous changes. You're probably quite familiar with the issues with the fuels tax as a mechanism for major funding of transportation. It's not responsive to rising costs of highway maintenance and construction, many of which are growing far faster than overall inflation. May not apply to all fuel types in some states. It's not adjusted often enough to keep up with inflation. vehicle miles per gallon are rising, so people can travel more miles for the same amount of tax, basically. And there's a problem with tax evasion in every state. When VMT fees are discussed, there are some potential advantages. They could be directly related to highway use, miles on the road. They could be equitably applied to any fuel type. Because of the technology, there would be the opportunity to use pricing to charge drivers more for periods and locations that they drive that are more congested. You could use the pricing to encourage the use of more fuel-efficient, cleaner cars. You could use the pricing to charge vehicles like heavy trucks that do more damage, more for each mile that they drive. And because of the opportunities for pricing, if you wanted to have a different balance of highways and transit in your biggest urban areas, you could do that. But there are also some disadvantages and a number of unresolved questions about the VMT fees. A lot of questions about technology. Which technology? How reliable would it have to be? How long would the transition to this system take? We know that it takes the fleet about 17 years to turn over. So clearly, for some fairly long period of time, we'd have to be collecting fuel taxes and VMT fees from the newer cars. Privacy concerns could be very large. A lot of drivers would be very concerned about any information being recorded about where they traveled and using that as a basis for calculating a fee. Security and enforceability are questions or issues. Unlike the fuels tax, which is collected at 1,400 wholesale distribution points, you'd be collecting VMT fees from individual drivers. So many, many, many more collections. And all kinds of transition details you'd have to work out between the federal government and the states and any sub-state, say, metropolitan area that wanted to collect a VMT fee on top of that as well. The Oregon pilot, which has been in the press a lot, was a 12-month pilot. They had a legislative mandate backing it up. It was designed to be revenue neutral by design. It wasn't designed to test a way that the state of Oregon could increase the funding to transportation. There was extensive public outreach before it, during it, and after it. And they were able to come up with the technology so that it all took place at the fuel pump. If your car was part of the experiment and was equipped with the technology, you could drive up to the pump. It would, with wireless communication, it would figure out how far you'd driven between zones and if any pricing charges applied for some of the cars, and it would debit this account that you had. If you didn't have a car that was equipped that way at these service stations, you'd just drive up and, you know, pay the regular fuel tax. Their assessment of it in a number of respects was quite positive. The participants that were in this study liked it, and a lot of them said they would continue doing it if it were to go on. The Oregon officials thought the feasibility was pretty good and that the revenue potential was favorable. You know, for a small-scale experiment, they thought the collection costs relative to the fuels tax were favorable. The accuracy of the technology was okay for a pilot. You know, this is a couple hundred participants, not a large group of people. They did find that they thought the reliability and security of the system needed improvement, and they did think that they would definitely need more information about startup costs and operations and maintenance costs. A small section of our paper is about market penetration of alternative fuel and hybrid vehicles. And we wish we had a crystal ball, but based on trends of late, it's pretty impossible to predict where hybrid sales in particular are going to go. They've been selling very rapidly, but it's such a recent phenomenon that it hasn't leveled off. It will level off at some point, but we don't know what that is and what their share of the market will be when that occurs. It's really just not a stable situation. nor is the situation right now where they haven't been able to produce hybrids fast enough because they didn't have batteries to put in them. That's not a stable market situation either. But about a million of them had been sold in the country by the end of 2007. We also
so, Larry, excuse me, the million, 1 million hybrid vehicles, was that in the course of 1 year, or is that cumulative over?
I think it's cumulative.
2 million then.
Is it 2 million now? Yeah.
I think it's almost 2 million net by 2009.
Yeah.
That's on the road.
Out of how many vehicles nationwide?
Oh.
100 million.
Oh, more than that.
Probably more than that.
Oh.
200 million.
200.
200 million? 300 million. They're more than there are people.
Yeah, I mean,
so, but still, it's on a percentage basis. It's
right, right.
A tiny percentage of the overall.
Yeah, I think I didn't do that portion of the paper, but I think they sell them about as quickly as they can bring them to market.
They're not selling now, by the way. Gas prices now.
Oh, really? Okay.
Check the pilot. It's slow today. It's a big article on it.
Wall Street Journal yesterday, I think.
And we looked at long-term trends in fuel economy, VMT growth, and gallons of gasoline sold. As I say, when you look at these things over a 30-year horizon, the picture's quite different than it's been certainly in the last 12 months, 18 months, 24 months. But if you look at the long-term trends, VMT would be expected to grow by about 1.75%. Fuel consumption has been growing for the country as a whole, has been growing ahead of projections at 2.3% per year. But the situation is not stable there either. Price increases that persist, and as well as, you know, the recession, clearly have the potential to decrease consumption and have. Just to summarize what we did and what's in the paper, the National Study Commissions believe that the fuels tax is viable until 2025. In other words, you might not need to have a totally different system for financing transportation in place right away. Despite the success of the small pilot in Oregon, there are a number of questions to be resolved, disadvantages. Both studies by national commissions strongly recommend that the next reauthorization contain considerable funding for research on VMT fees and how they would be rolled out. There's this large study going on of user acceptance of the VMT fees, which, you know, might find some different things than Oregon did with a bigger group of people. There's the concern out there that any transition would be a very long-term process, and there would need to be a considerable amount of coordination of standards and policies to do this. It would be a real sea change. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Larry. Mr. Bowie.
Did your study reveal anything that caused you to believe that the legislators would have the courage to enact it?
We didn't have an interview component of the study. I have lived in Virginia for a long time, so, you know.
We refer to those things, Mr. Chairman, as idiosyncratic facts.
And they seem to be sensitive to privacy concerns.
As well as did any of the studies involve looking at trucks only or at trucks specifically for this type of tax? Because that would seem to me they already have the GPS. I mean, they're already, it's much more set up for this. And I just thought that might.
There are, it's not exactly the same, but there are four states, Oregon's one of them, that do a weight distance tax on trucks. But it's more low tech. The trucks have to report their weight, and they have to report the miles driven in Oregon, say, for example. In Oregon, you know, and basically the more loads you're putting on a smaller right. number of axles, the more you get charged. And Oregon is one state where they pay that instead of the fuels tax or the registration fee. But as you can imagine, if you put a lot of weight on not so many axles, it's pretty hefty weight distance fee. I think New York has it, Kentucky has it, and New Mexico has it. but it's not nearly as technologically based as this proposal.
Well, I just like the idea of having some way of capturing, if we're in a maintenance mode, the wear and tear that these heavy trucks do put on the roads. It's a little independent of this study, but
sure.
Ms. Connelly, that's a wonderful question. The governor had a piece of legislation that did not survive committee trying to do a calculation of the distance and the weight effect on it as a one-time fee. But your question, I think, has piqued a lot of curiosity around the table, and we'll be following up on that as well. Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chairman, by listing tax evasion as a disadvantage for fuel tax, but not as an issue with BMT, is that really supposed to suggest that it wouldn't be, or is that covered under enforceability?
No, it could be. Okay. For one thing, there are ways to block GPS signals. So, yeah, and this has not been tested on a large scale yet, obviously, but I'm sure that there would be, evasion problems with VMT fees. For sure.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate this. It's not whether or not, Ms. O'Leary, you could approve that this was the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do, but it's important for us to look at there has to be some alternatives, and we need to begin exploring them, and some of them may be better on the margin than what we're doing now. Some of them may be cause more problems than they solve. I know, for example, the tax structure in Oregon doesn't include a general sales tax that we have. For example, we devote some pennies to transportation. So it's a different situation. But I was just going to suggest we could dedicate the use tax in Virginia, which is a huge collection. I'm kidding. But I appreciate you doing the survey, because it's something we need to understand, because this is offered up. This is offered up by those who don't actually want to face the revenue question, as if this is the golden answer to the question. And the fact it's still collecting a tax, and you still, what I like is the potential to adjust this tax a little more readily. The way that local governments have been forced to do that with their property taxes, to adjust the rate to match sort of their responsibilities, instead of just what you were condemning earlier, let's see how much money shows up each year, and then that's what we'll use. You can't run a transportation system like that. I mean, we couldn't do it really before, but we certainly can't do it now. So I appreciate it. I would suggest that we try to figure out a way to do something to test this concept in Virginia. I like the idea of the trucks, or pick some segment, not just the best citizens to do it, because they'll be honest and they'll even say they like it, whether they do or not, because they were chosen. Study. I've got to be positive here, but some way to begin breaking us out of the sterile debate that, well, we just, gasoline taxes do it, we got to have something else. I mean, we need to plan those things.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? There's a second part to this presentation. Ralph Davis is going to continue to talk a little bit about perhaps some interim options in this regard.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. As Dr. O'Leary, by the way, Dr. O'Leary's full report is available on the VTrans website if you want to read. Dr. O'Leary and the national experts are pretty much saying that this robust type of mileage tax is decade out. Technology issues, driver privacy concerns, collection, security and enforcement type issues. Regarding the evasion, you could evade the type of tax, you could pull out your GPS unit, which prevents you from doing that. So you do have your evasion issues there. In the meantime, over the next 10 years or so, transportation costs will continue to outgrow revenues. So what I basically wanted to do was to provide a follow-up to the Research Council study and developing a mileage tax option, something that could be, if it's the desire of those who make those kind of decisions, that could be implemented in the return. And that's kind of what this presentation does. I guess my modus operandi is find solutions. Yeah. And that's That's some of what this is, given that everyone is saying this is conventional wisdom. This is 10 years out. By the way, I am sitting on a national panel that's looking at this issue and looking at trying to come up with solutions to be implemented by 2015. So I am doing that work as well. But for this purpose, it really was, is this something we can do within the next couple of years? And that's the purpose of, if you got the presentation in advance, you wanted these to duplicate it or not, this is a follow-up to what Dr. O'Leary had done. There's some mileage-based tax myths. One is that these taxes would eliminate tax-based erosion. The only way that they would do that is if they're not revenue neutral. In fact, what you would have to do is put some kind of increase on this, as you would have to put some kind of increase on the gas tax. It would have to be adjusted for inflation. So a lot of the issues that you have the gas tax, you would also have this mileage-based tax. Another myth that I'm calling is that it's not subject to the economic fluctuations and fuel prices, that you have fuel taxes. I would point that both VMT and gasoline sales decreased about 4% last year as a result of the changing economy and increases in fuel prices. So the mileage taxes, you really need to look at them a bit more to say, are they the solution? And I would offer that they have a lot of issues that the current tax on gasoline has. So if there are these myths, why would we even consider it? And this graph kind of suggests why we would consider it. As we look out, essentially, gasoline sales, as the number of more fuel-efficient vehicles enter into the fleet, there's a chance that gasoline sales will not increase. If VMT is increasing at about 2% a year, there are projections from the Energy Information Administration which says that the efficiency of the vehicle stock also going to increase around 1.6 to 2% a year. As the impact of the CAFE standard 2007 come into play, which requires more fuel efficient vehicles, you've got the efficiency of the stock increasing at about the rate of the employee. So in effect, what happens is you get little or no growth in gasoline sales, or tax on gasoline sales. You do get some growth in VMT. So that's what one thing that makes this kind of attractive as you look out. Flat decreasing, no growth in gasoline sales, you do have some increase in VMT. So we as consumers are using these roads at a high level, but we're not paying for the use. That's kind of VMT. The other important thing on this particular chart that shows is that over the last 20 years, and a lot of us don't know this, but VMT and gasoline sales increased at about the same rate over the last 20 years. And some of that happened because in the 90s, essentially the fuel economy started to decrease. So basically people were traveling, gasoline sales were increasing and so forth. So VMT and gasoline inked this thing, it shows about 50% over the last 20 years. At the same time, the cost of us to build and maintain roads shot up significantly. So that's the point in this chart is there are several. One that over the last 20 years, VMT and gasoline sales increased at about the same rate. Cost to maintain roads increased significantly. As we look out, we still have this gap between the cost of maintaining and building the roads and we have this flat gasoline tax that being solved the roads. So some of what we want is how can we fix some of this? And that's some of what this proposal or this option that I'm suggesting would come into play.
Mr. Davis, if I could just point out the year 2002 is the bottom of that trough. I believe that was the year that Mr. Davies and the class of 2002 came to this board. This graph alone explains an awful lot of pain that has been experienced in that time frame. It's stunning, really. For those of you who have been on this board since July of 2002 know exactly what I'm talking about.
Right.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Mr. White.
Mr. Davis,
How is vehicle miles travel measured on an aggregate basis on this chart?
On aggregate, it's basically collected by VDOT. They have a report for federal reasons. I don't know exactly the techniques that are used, but it's reported on an annual basis, and that's essentially what I'm tracking. I can get the detail. I mean, the Secretary has some issues with this, with how it's collected, and he always has, but it's used for a number of reasons, and we provide it to the federal government as a total.
Well, it must be on some sort of sampling basis, and then those samples are extrapolated into a total. Because there's no way, we don't have the ability to measure aggregate vehicle miles traveled.
That's correct. It's based on performance time.
Thank you.
The comment I would make on that with this sample, I think some of what you look at is, and some of what this chart is not necessarily trying to pinpoint accuracy but trends. And I think the same thing happens with VMT, is some of what you might look at is trends, and then samples capture trend, whether or not it's 82 billion miles, 82.1, we don't know, but we do know that when it goes down, the sampling captures that trend, and I think that's the importance of the data.
Mr. Chairman, looking at that chart, again, that four-year explosion there between 5 and 9, it just doesn't look, it's an anomaly of some type. That doesn't look accurate.
That's the PPI for highway construction, reflecting the increase in gas prices and so forth, and gas prices essentially doubled the last year. So I was, and the price of gas figures into add for in the cost of construction. If you were to look at the CPI by itself, you wouldn't see that tremendous increase in those last several years. CPI, which is another measure, would have been constantly above both the gasoline sales as well as VMT. But it is a steep increase, and I would say the increase in gas prices reflected in construction and asphalt costs and so forth.
But it's not just gasoline. It's global demand for cement, for asphalt, for aggregate, and for labor. All of those things have escalated rapidly over the last 7 years.
Ms. Conley, did you have a question?
No.
Sorry.
On the space tax option, this is a really relatively simplistic method of trying to deal with the miles tax. Everyone said it can't happen. One has to put an inch in 10 years. But what this is an option to have. One time I called it the virtual VMT tax. It's a way of getting at the growth in the VMT that's used. In this chart here, the VMT is going up. Aggregate VMT is going up. Gasoline sales flat, maybe even decrease. It's a way to get at this VMT, growth in this VMT, without having all the issues of trying to put a GPS unit in a car. And that approach is what's on 5, 6, and 7. And it basically says, the way to get at VMT, which is essentially the same thing, is look at the rate of growth in aggregate VMT. Take that rate of growth in aggregate VMT, place gas tax by that number. And what you would have is something that essentially is a kind of a use tax for the fact that you're buying gasoline at this rate and you're using it at that rate. So I'm suggesting that an option is to increase the gas tax by the rate of growth in VMT. This is, addition to the gas tax is not unheard of. We have something called petroleum storage, underground storage petroleum tax, which is in addition to gas tax deal with the tanks stored underground. At one time we had something called oil excise tax, which was a 3% tax on top of the gas tax. So the idea of putting something on top of the gas tax is not unusual. I won't go through all the detail, but that's the concept. Part of the concept would also be to establish some kind of floor. So this thing wouldn't drop below a certain level. Also would suggest that there would be an inflation factor. Again, the whole purpose here is everyone is saying that you can't have this mileage tax for another 10 years, and I'm suggesting that maybe there is a way you can do this that doesn't have all of the negatives associated with the full-fledged shuttle bus tax.
The next chart is an example of how this thing would work. I will not go through the details. You can look through that at the leisure. But in this one, just an example where it was established. You look at the rate of growth in mileage over the last 7-8 years or so, and you're kind of inflating the gas tank by that amount, and I've said that's the mileage tax adding to the gas tank. So that's just what this is. What are the benefits? Well, I can't design doing this is going to do, quite frankly. Is it directly related to how we're used? It mimics mileage tax without having all the negatives of privacy. There's no privacy, there's no technology issue, there are no administrative issues. So in terms of concern not there to get this principle of gas tax or a new additional difficulties. One of the things on mileage tax that we don't talk about a lot, that we heard a lot about last year, is in-state versus out-of-state users. If Virginia imposes, develops a mileage tax, that mileage tax would be on Virginia users unless we're crafty enough to figure out how to get it. Basically, as you drive your car, you report your mileage to Virginia mileage. So if you're an out-of-stater, you wouldn't be paying that mileage tax. That's one thing that's not talked about much on mileage tax. And we went through a lot of that last year on the views of being in-state versus out-of-state. This thing is essentially, if you put the 2 cents or whatever on your gas tax, you say, you're using those facilities, then you need to pay as well as everyone else. Limited public burden, we've heard about what a penny is or 2 cents is on a gas tax and what kind of impact that can have. So those are the benefits of this option. Drawbacks, well, there's some increase in the tax, and we know how powerful that is. You cannot deal with the alternative fuel vehicles. One of the big things on the mileage based tax is the fact that we're going to have hybrid vehicles, electric vehicles, and so forth down the road, and there needs to be a way to figure out how do you assess those vehicles for the use of the filter. This particular version, the electric car, there's no way under the current gas tax that you can tax the electric car. I would suggest that there's a tension between us taxing the developing industry and financing roads. And we have to deal with that tension. How do you tax the electric car at the same time you're trying to grow that industry? And that's probably an issue out there that tension sits there. It does not provide any means for such a full-fledged gas tax, a full-fledged VAT tax, where you could do the congestive pricing based on time of the day, your speed, that your pay would increase, and so forth. This is a flat tax that increases with inflation. So there are limitations of this. But again, the option is, the next 10 years, we're not going to see a mileage tax because it's too complex. There probably is a way to get at a mileage tax, and that's what this option is.
I'm happy to answer
any questions
that you
might have.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. McCarthy. Well, at the end of the day, what we're trying to figure out is how to balance what kind of a program we're trying to deliver, whether there's going to be anything new in it, or whether we're going to be pretty much a maintenance-only organization for roads and bridges and pavements. We're trying to figure out how to finance that, and I do think this board ought to talk about that side of the equation, how to finance it. And I'm also a great believer in the philosopher's Occam's razor, that sometimes the simplest answer is the best one, and you know where I'm going with that. Let's just raise the gas tax straightforwardly. However, to do that, I understand we need to explain why. And what Ralph has very cogently done is provided one rationale for raising the gas tax, because at the end of the day, that's what his proposal comes down to, is raising the gas tax. I would think we could get there simpler and more directly with a more tangible example rather than the complex set of equations that is involved in his particular rationale, which I appreciate. I don't agree with, but I appreciate it. And that is to say, how about a study that specifies what bridges we need to replace and repair over the next decade, what pavements we need to repair over the next decade, and add up that amount of money and say we need X amount increase in the tax on gasoline over the next decade
to accomplish that revenue supply to meet those specific needs, and that it would be tied strictly to those projects, and anything else we get we'll use as best we can for what we're already doing. Because short of increasing the revenue, we're not going to do any of these things, it seems. And so the question is, as he rightly puts it, and as the study puts it, is how are we going to find more revenue to do what we've been doing? Well, we're not going to be doing what we've been doing, for one thing. It will change. And secondly, the simplest approach, in my view, is to tell the public what they're going to get for a specific cost and sell that idea. And I would like to think an articulate spokesperson could make that argument to the public, especially when you compare the alternatives. More potholes, more closed bridges, more rotten pavement, et cetera, lower services, et cetera. I mean, the public, that's what they see. So I think Dr. Davis made the point earlier. They don't see all the stuff that we see. They see the net result. And if somebody ever told them that there was really a connection between what they're willing to pay for specific results, my bet is that they might buy into that in a modest way. You know, I'm not talking about a climate change initiative where we need to raise the gasoline tax by a dollar or something to change behavior. I'm just talking about fixing bridges, fixing pavements, and if that costs $100 million a year or more to do, then I think we ought to find a way to sell the public that idea. And raising the gas tax while we figure out what else to do as an alternative, because we're not going to solve this problem this year. We're going to have to deal with it over the next decade. And while we're dealing with it, we got real problems that need solutions. And I'm happy to go out and make that case with anybody that will deliver more cheaply than any alternative available specific results for a specific amount of money. And I don't see us doing that right now. And I would like to see some kind of help from the research council or whoever the right place is to say, here's what it would actually amount to if you took that proactive approach to X number of bridges, Y miles of pavement, and this amount of cost, and translating that into the gas tax.
Mr. McCarthy, reason for these briefings are this is essentially a chapter in the V-Trans document that we'll approve by the end of this year. And if we can knit this together into a coherent whole, we've talked about instead of an unconstrained needs list, the top 10 or 12 investment priorities, one of which obviously is going to be just maintaining what we already have and methods and means to achieve those. So I think we'll have our shot at that. And Dr. Tischer's here probably going a little bit nuts over that. But, you know, this is what we've been talking since January is future, the list is future direction, future direction of transportation. And to have a sober assessment and a set of choices laid out, both in terms of a positive direction forward as well as the very significant challenges we face. But we all know in this business you can't do anything without revenue, and there are a lot of different ways to raise revenue as we know. I would note, and again, there's a lot of focus on the gas tax, and you mentioned climate change. One of the questions is, are we trying to dampen VMT? You tax VMT, presumably you do that. You're trying to discourage carbon emissions, then perhaps you want to tax carbon. I think those are hard choices and something we need to think about in the context of this discussion. I think R2D2 is
very upset.
There for carbon.
Just yeah. Spitting it out.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, if I could add to your comment, I think one of the guidance you've given us is to look at 10 to 12 of key investments. And I think one of the differences in 2035 and 2025 is I think those 10 or 12 key investments, events like bridges and pavements and so forth, would certainly, at least in today's environment, figure within that. And we know, we've seen numbers on the cost for bridge to deal with construction, efficient bridges. That number is published as a VDOT number. So we know those kinds of numbers, and I think we're looking at a state of the approach we use for 2025 is to look at something that's feasible and viable, and those kind of things such as building structures and bridges and pavement and those kind of numbers is probably the direction we're going to head towards the end of this. That's what's a very big needs kind of numbers that we know we know or never.
We'll still have gigantic numbers, so
yeah.
I'm sure. Ms. Conley. Ms. Coolman.
Mr. Chairman. First of all, I think this is tremendous. I mean, it's exactly the kind of creative thinking that we need. You know, one of our problems is systemic. We plan looking forward, but we adjust our revenues looking backwards. This still has a little bit of that weakness, so, you know, what I would say to improve it would be actually to have a projection factor forward, so we're adjusting revenues in real time to what we're actually seeing, as opposed to adjusting looking backwards. But I'll tell you this. This, to me, is the equivalent of that chart that former Governor Mark Warner carried around some years ago to show the parallel lines that never meet. I mean, you cannot deal with the budget difficulties, he said, but these lines never meet. They just keep going on out into space as many years as you want to kick the can down the road or whatever the analogy is. I'd love to see this actually supported directly with the data that you have and distributed somehow so that this can become the basic discussion document that everybody who's involved on that long list of who we have to consult with, yeah, this is really what's happening. This, all the rest is just temporary stuff. I think it breaks your idea, while it needs work, and we ought to actually look at how to work it. It breaks out of the inertia of, are you for more gas tax or against it? It begins to introduce a dynamic pricing element that says we should actually, on an annual basis, adjust our revenue sources because we're in a dynamic economy. I mean, it goes up, it goes down. It's, we have very volatile sources of funding for transportation now, just like we found out. They all went south at the same time. And we're facing big problems. I mean, Rita Busher's, what I took out of Rita Busher's briefing is this. We used to say, as good conservative business people, that we don't want to saddle, we can't afford to saddle our children with debt. Well, now she told us, actually, we can't afford to saddle our children with debt. We don't actually have the money
to issue
the debt. Well, you know, that's pretty bottom line. The other thing she mentioned is we potentially face a 20-year drought between 2016 and 2035 when we can't issue bonds. Whoa. That's not a short-term problem that goes away. Combined with this chart, it basically says,
close up shop.
Pack it up. There's no actual way for us to responsibly do what we're charged with doing under the Constitution of Virginia. So I'd like to see this dress up. I'd like to see us really pursue this as a new idea. And if it can't be, if it has to be a pilot program, if you've got to pick out, like, let's let Fairfax County try it out first. You know, hey, Mikey, they'll try anything. I mean, whatever it is, we need to begin to put alternatives forward and not just be trapped in this sterile discussion that we've been trapped in for 5-6 years. And I appreciate you moving this ahead. I think you've taken a good step ahead.
Mr. Martin.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Davis, there might be an additional drawback to the option that would galvanize certain segments of the population against it, if indeed it's true. So correct me if I'm wrong. Is it true that we have a situation where certain segments of the population get older or for whatever reason start driving fewer VMT while the average VMT goes up? I'm driving fewer, but my taxes are going up.
I'm not quite sure I understand your question. Different segments
of the population, for whatever reason, people changing jobs, people getting older, whatever reason, a significant number who are driving fewer miles on an annual basis.
That's correct. I think the long-term trends are not the same as history. When we look at VMT projections out, the longer-term trends are slow for a number of reasons. Aging population, pricing changes, economy changes, and so forth. So if you look out, the long-term growth in VMT is not going to be at the level of the historical growth. You can see some slowdown.
My point is, acknowledge that as a drawback so that you don't have people in the population for whom that's true taking pot shots and saying, oh no, it's going to cause my taxes to go up unfairly.
Quite frankly, I think the proposal I have is probably better than the more robust type of VMT because they will be assessed basically on your mileage, the miles traveled, where you travel, and so forth. In your case, with a VMT type tax, just as you travel less, in your case, if it's an elderly person or whatever, the VMT tax would be based on your miles traveled, so it would be lesser.
But the option makes my taxes go up. With the trend.
The option would make your taxes go up to the extent that the gasoline sales are flat, your taxes may not go up. But the option, which is on top of gas tax, certainly your taxes will go up.
Yes.
Unless you drove if you drove less.
I guess the other point I would make, if you look at the mileage,
okay, final question. Ms. Conley.
Oh, it's not, Chris. It's just a comment. I think it's, I like the idea of kind of dressing the table anew, and although this is just a variant of the gas tax, it gives us an opportunity to look at it as a whole and to put the inflation factor in there, and you could adjust for some of these inequities maybe through the income tax. I mean, you could adjust it as part of a big revenue package, that, because I can see that could be an equity issue. But maybe that could be taken care of in some other way. Yeah. but I think this is a good new way of presenting the issue, at least.
Very thoughtful, Marion. Thank you, Mr. Davis. We're obviously going to come back to that. We have one more presentation on a legislative update. I'm sure it will be brief, as in brevity is rewarded and the soul of wit. There is also a very detailed handout legislative report. I would encourage you to keep this with you. Mm-hmm. You will get calls from legislators, for example, asking, what did I do on that particular item, or what does it do? This is helpful to have and also to be able to answer questions from localities. Welcome, Mr. Donahue.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. As the Chairman said, I'm here to provide a brief update on the goings-on down the street with our 140 members of the General Assembly the last several months. There were two agency and administration proposals. VDOT did have two agency proposals that they submitted for that session. One, which I call System of State Highways, provides a mechanism for the transfer of highways from the primary system of state highways to the local system. Ms. Connelly and Mr. Fulmer, you may recall, in 2006, when we tried to transfer Columbia Turnpike from the primary system of highways to the local system, as they requested, but you go through a very convoluted process to accomplish that. And so now there's a legislative path that has been created where it can streamline that process. VDOT's other legislative proposal was based on the report the Virginia Transportation Research Council did on overweight vehicles, and it would have established a flat $250 fee to try and recover some of the cost that these overweight vehicles cause that currently is not captured today. That proposal was not successful. It was, I believe, seven other proposals that were based on that study have been sent to the Joint Commission on Transportation Accountability. They will be discussed and reviewed this interim, and legislation may or may not be recommended in the next session. DRPT introduced two proposals this session as well. Both of their proposals were successful. The first proposal provides the agency with the authority to provide a safety oversight for the Norfolk Light Rail Project. This is a requirement of the Federal Administration for the Norfolk Light Rail Project to operate. Their other proposal was a proposal to provide the DRPT director with the same contracting authority that the VDOT commissioner currently has. And this will allow them to enter into contracts up to $2 million for architectural and engineering services. And this can help reduce the cost for some of their consulting services they use, for example, the statewide rail plan and the surface transportation plan. There are three administration proposals I would like to discuss. The first is a proposal that deals with private activity bonds. The private activity bonds are tax-exempt bonds that can be issued for public-private partnership projects, and they require a private sector proposal, but they also require a governmental authority to be the issuer of those bonds, even though they're supported by either toll or private sector equity. And currently in Virginia, there was no established authority that could issue these bonds for PPTA projects. And what this proposal does is it allows the Virginia Small Business Financing Authority to issue these tax-exempt bonds for PPTA transportation projects. And as the board may recall, the Capitol Beltway project was the first transportation project in the nation to use private activity bonds last year, and one of the issues we ran into with that project is there was not authority in place to allow that issuance to occur, so one had to be created for it. Another proposal was a bill that amends the Metro Compact. These amendments are necessary due to the federal railroad legislation that was passed this past year, and it will allow the Commonwealth, it's one step to allow Metro to be eligible to receive $150 million in annual federal funds. The next proposal is a proposal as a recommendation of the Governor's Climate Change Commission. It revises some of the requirements in the statewide transportation plan and really puts a focus on corridors of statewide significance and then also on networks of regional significance, kind of looking at how we promote mobility on our statewide corridors, but then also ensure that people can get around from A to B within the regions where they live. This proposal also provided the Office of Intermodal Planning and Investment with the authority to establish standards for the coordination of transportation investments and land use planning. So, for example, in the future, if there's a new type of transit funding or something else, it may say, you can apply for this if you would like it, but we may ask that you provide some type of land use that will make the transit successful. The bill also extends the transportation and land use performance measures that were created in House Bill 3202 and currently only apply to Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads. And these are things like job, housing ratio, job and housing access to transit and HOV facilities, and it extends these to the other urban areas of the states, and they would be developed by those regions so those can be used as they consider their projects and regional priorities.
And just to note, we've talked several times about V-Trans. This legislation provides additional work that we have to incorporate into that V-Trans document. Very, very important long-term legislation, which is identifying major corridors of statewide and or regional significance. And the notion of having land use as well as transportation performance measures for every region is has huge potential for success as well as for conflict.
There were several pieces of legislation that dealt with transportation authorities. One piece repealed the Hampton Roads Transportation Authority. That was a successful measure both in the House and the Senate. There were two new transportation authorities created this session. One is the George Washington Toll Road Authority, and this authority would have the authority to construct a toll road in the Virginia Route 3 corridor, which actually is not Route 3, but in between Route 3 and another parallel road in Spotsylvania County. Its toll rate would be capped at $1 without approval from the participating jurisdictions. There was also the Charlottesville-Albemarle Regional Transit Authority, which was also established. And, it is tasked with developing a regional transit plan, also with implementing that transit plan with any resources that may become available to the authority. The authority does not have any special taxing authority, nor would the local governing bodies that are members given any special taxing authority. The proposal that would have done that was defeated in committee. There are several other PPTA proposals. I believe the board has been briefed on these previously. Generally, luckily, all these proposals failed. We did oppose them, and that was generally just because it introduced new regulatory risk and would have put in place time frames that really don't work and are appropriate for the complex and business transactions that apply with PPTA negotiations. There are a couple other proposals I would like to hit on here briefly. One is a proposal that would allow for an emergency replacement of the Jordan Bridge in Chesapeake. As the board may recall, this facility was closed last fall due to its structural integrity. And what this proposal will do will allow private operator to come in and build a 100% private facility that will be owned and operated by that company. There's also a bill that will allow the use of state right-of-way for renewable energy transmission lines to connect them with the power grid. The Secretary of Transportation is now encouraged to assist in the establishment of the Virginia Association of Metropolitan Planning Organizations. And this, the purpose of this group is to put in place more discussion between various regional MPOs on best practices and other tasks the MPOs currently conduct. And there was one other bill that dealt with the transfer of development rights. This was a land use measure that the administration supported back in 2006. And what this new provision would do is it streamlines this process. Transfer of development rights is a process where development rights, without any action of the local governing body, can be taken from one area of locality and then attached within an area of locality if they want to concentrate growth. Under the old system, the rights could be attached or removed from one piece of land but had to be immediately attached to another piece. This legislation will allow the banking of development rights where they can be severed and then traded freely without being attached directly to a parcel of land. Mm-hmm. There's just a few other proposals, Mr. Chairman. One is House Bill 1835. This states that the Department of Rail and Public Transportation's Rail Enhancement Fund needs to take into account traffic congestion, environmental quality, and rail capacity along identified corridors when it considers the public benefit of Rail Enhancement Fund applications. There was a proposal that failed that would have required the Joint Legislative and Audit and Review Commission to study passenger and freight rail funding needs. There was also another failed proposal that would have required the CTB to use the biennial asset management report to allocate the funds used for asset maintenance. And another proposal that failed, Mr. Chairman, was a proposal that would have directed the Department of Transportation to develop local corridor access management plans along the Route 29 corridor to help preserve the existing capacity of that roadway. And one proposal that I failed to put in my presentation was a proposal that would cap the local option commercial real estate tax in Northern Virginia. As you all may recall, that was authorized in House Bill 3202 and is one of only two remaining local option revenue sources, and it would reduce it from a current cap of 25 cents down to 12 and a half cents. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Mr. Chairman, when does that Commission on Transportation Accountability meet, and what is their makeup?
The Commission on Transportation Accountability is a joint House-Senate commission. It meets at the call of the chairman, who currently is Delegate Joe May.
Do you think it would be good? Could we get our name on the notification list when they do that?
We typically get about 24 hours notice and have to put together a presentation. And I'll be happy to make that.
I think it would be fun to go to and learn from. and strategize for them, I guess.
Maybe we ought to have a joint meeting. That's cool.
That's a good idea.
Mr. Chairman, did the cap on the commercial property tax pass?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry. That was House Bill 2479. Okay. That was adopted by pretty strong margins in both bodies.
Chairman,
one thing I should note about that bill, there was an amendment later in the stage that said the cap only will last 5 years.
And that was not retroactive, though?
I don't believe any of the local jurisdictions currently impose the tax higher than 12 and a half cents, and that may have been the reason that the cap chosen for the legislation.
Quick question. First of all, to observe, I applaud you, Mr. Secretary, and the Governor for successfully beating down these PPTA bills, which really would have closed off a lot of options that we have to rely on going forward. I have a question about the Jordan Bridge. Is there actively a company that's pursuing this, or this just makes it possible?
Yes, sir. There is a company, I believe, that's entered into a contract with the city of Chesapeake to construct this facility. I believe once this bill is signed and sent back down, I believe they will move forward. My understanding.
And then the question about the, Mr. Chairman, about the allocation of maintenance funds based on performance measures. Did that fail because the concept was flawed, or did it fail because the politics just didn't allowed whoever was carrying the bill to move ahead?
Well, I would say it would be a mix of the two. There were certain legislators who thought their parts of the state might be neglected if the funds were allocated solely based on the performance measures that are established in VDOT by any time. There may be some other reasons as well.
Well said, Mr. Donahue. Mr. Dickens.
He's almost as good as Rick Walton.
Mr. Dickens.
I think your idea of a joint meeting makes an awful lot of sense, and it would be, I think, very appropriate if we were able to have Rita present some of the same numbers that she presented to us, to those folks, and have some of the VTRANS information of studies and work that we're doing. I think it'd be a great idea.
Okay. Cool. See if there is any receptivity to that. Okay, thank you, Mr. Donahue. And I do want to acknowledge, Mr. Donahue, your unbelievable work this session, the credibility you have achieved in a very short period of time with a lot of people from disparate interests is very impressive. And I know a lot of folks around this table work the legislative process and have seen that, and we all sincerely thank you and appreciate your great work. Mr. Walton, did you have anything you want to add? Mr. Badger? Okay, that being the case, dinner is at 6:30 at La Grotta. I know time is short, and so I apologize for this long work session, but there's a lot of important but difficult work ahead. We'll see everybody at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. Thank you, and the meeting's adjourned.
La Grotta.